Today's podcast is sponsored by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/GOT and using GOT as a promo code at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 6, Episode 4, entitled Book of the Stranger. I know we did the instant cast, but has your opinion changed?
I almost forgot my own damn name. It's going to be one of those podcasts. I've seen this three times now, and I like it. It's interesting because I continue to like it. I'm more at peace with the end because I felt like the slight resistance I had to it was kind of silly in retrospect. It's entirely a thing that the books can be one way and the show can be another. And also, I haven't even read the damn book. So until George decides to release it, I'll decide whether I want to call him a liar in the future. And then we'll talk about that more later. The Jon and Sansa thing, I'm going to watch it at least one more time before the spoiler podcast. But it gets me every fucking time. Every time.
Okay.
And
it hasn't gotten me once.
Well, you know, there that's kind of your thing.
I guess so.
But yeah, no, I thought it was great. And the stuff that is, you know, the quiet moments between the different characters, Littlefinger's machinations, the more I've had time to think about that, and the Lannister-Tyrell alliance and how that's going to promise to be a clusterfuck. It's all really good. This is a really strong episode of Game of Thrones. And really, like, I felt like there's a little bit of unrest and uneasiness in the first three episodes, even though shit, so much happened. But, like, you know, there was wasn't a lot of progress beyond what we kind of expected to happen. And this is where, man, you can really see, like, how can they walk back Dany? Like, how can she not completely conquer Slaver's Bay and then go to Westeros from here?
Yeah.
She needs boats.
Well, she needs boats to do the Westeros thing.
She needs ships and boats. But yeah, I mean, there's stuff that's actually happening. And I think, you know, that's a lot of the great television shows take a few episodes to set things up so that they can just really, you know, knock you on your ass. So that's my opinion. What about you?
Yeah, I'm of roughly the same opinion. I think it's a really strong episode. And I like, you know, how they're knocking the pins down, but they're also setting up another lane, right? They're setting up the stuff with
bowling
Robin and Littlefinger. Absolutely. And they're bowling strikes most of the time. Couple spares, maybe a 7-10 split every once in a while. But yeah, it seems like they're doing a lot to keep the plot moving now on certain threads while they're setting up others.
Yeah.
So I think that's the best way to tell this story because there are so many parts to it.
Yeah.
Those are the episodes I like the most where, you know, maybe it's a little bit forgettable on the setup threads, but those big plot moments are hitting, you know, while other stuff is going down.
I also thought that this was a great episode for some of the Game of Thrones humor. Like, I feel like some of the humor just that usually is something you can rely on has missed this season. But I thought all the stuff that, like, Tormund eye-fucking Brienne and her not really, I mean, she wasn't threatened because I feel like that's why it wasn't creepy, because Brienne in any given day could beat Tormund's ass for him.
Probably, yeah.
But to the fact, like, maybe this is the first guy who's actually looked at her that way without any kind of irony or agenda, and she's like, this is all new, and it's just great. It was a great human moment.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff to even...
And it's good that it's not one of the Black brothers doing it, because...
Yeah.
You could say, oh, well, they haven't seen a woman in a long time, and, like, maybe they're just taking the first thing that comes along. But Tormund, he does what he wants,
I mean,
you know?
So, like, she's like, holy shit, I get with this woman, and my children are kings.
Uh-huh.
You put me and her genetics together, holy cow, we're just going to birth a dynasty.
Right.
And, like, I like this strong woman. It's great. I really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the plus Brienne kind of has walked in and owned the room this whole episode. Like,
absolutely.
You know, when the gates open and she's there in the middle and she's flanked by Sansa and Pod, freaking awesome. She's, you know, riding around and everybody's just kind of like, holy shit, look at the, it's great.
It good is. Stuff. Yeah, we'll get to all these scenes individually and talk about them more. Do you have anything you want to say before we get into the recap?
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, we got something cool to announce, which is we're going to be doing the rare appearance, in-person appearance at the Rocket City NerdCon, which is taking place in downtown Huntsville, Alabama, Saturday, October 22nd from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. to Sunday, October 23 from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's cool. A lot of people think in Alabama and nerd and science fiction stuff. Apparently, might not know this, but Huntsville is a base of operation for NASA. Yeah. And as a child, I actually toured the space facility they got down there, and it's really cool. They got a lot of Saturn and Atlas rockets and stuff that you can go look at, but they actually have this NerdCon, which is they're saying they're a celebration of all things nerdy. If your fanaticism for pop culture, comic books, movies, TV, books, games, collectibles, crafting, cosplay, LARPing, etc., borders on obsessive, this is the place for you. Come meet other people who geek out over similar subjects and let your inner nerd geek flag fly. Jim and I are going to be one of those nerds and geeks down there. We're going to be doing a couple panels at least. Probably
You're
going
implying
to be
that we're this like two-headed beast of a thing.
Aren't we?
We're going to be one of them? I think we're going to be two of them.
We're going to be a unit of two people. We're going
right.
to be...
Who may or may not be sharing a shirt. I don't know.
That's yet to be... It could be like, the God of Death versus the Lord of Light. You know, are they all the same thing with two different heads? Or are they distinct aspects of one entity? Who knows? Well, you got to show up at Huntsville to find out.
You do.
And it's... I was amazed to find out that it's only a six-hour drive from Cincinnati. So it's a pretty good radius if you want to come say hi. I'm sure there's going to be some post-con revelry, probably mm-hmm. getting beers afterwards and socializing. And all during the con, we're going to have like a designated place for you to go. If you want to check out some information about it, you can go to rocketcitynerdcon.org. You can also follow them on Facebook and Twitter to get up to date. I know they're not selling tickets yet, but I think that is imminent, and we'll probably have another announcement when you can actually buy tickets. Mm-hmm. We're going to have some con-exclusive Bald Move merchandise to bring down there if you want to pick up a t-shirt or something. Hell, I don't know why you'd want one, but I'll sign an autograph. I will talk with you. We might be playing some games. Like, I don't know what all is going to go down there, but I tend to love all that shit. And I know at least one of our panels is going to be something... at least tangibly related to Game of Thrones as well. But more on that later. So again, if you want to meet us, if you're from the South, it sounds like a really cool opportunity. I'm excited to get down there. RocketCityNerdCon.org, and we will have upcoming announcements with more information as we get it.
Okay, then let's do it. Ed asked John how the hell he can leave the wall when he knows what's coming. And before they can kind of resolve this argument, Sansa's party shows up, and there's a teary reunion between her and Jon, big hugs. They go inside, and they reminisce for a while before Sansa tries to convince him to take back Winterfell, which he promptly refuses to do.
Yeah, I'm glad that Ed got pissed and they had this conversation, because this is something that would naturally... Yeah, okay, this is what we talked about last week on Oathbreaker. Okay, you technically might be... Mm-hmm. free from your oaths, but you're really fucking us here, John. But John came back with like
the strongest of arguments. I was murdered. Yeah, don't you understand?
You want me to stay here,
right?
It's like, so they can get it right the next time. I thought it was intelligent driven, passionate characters having different points of view that are all valid.
Yeah.
And there's no real easy answer for it.
Right. I do think that John shut Ed up there at the end. Like, how do you argue with I was murdered and
no, I mean, sure.
I can't stay here.
But it's also equally true that John's the best man for the job. And
oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I also wonder, you know, where how is this going to be resolved, this thing where it's kind of elegant the way they've set it up, because it's not necessarily with this letter that comes out later on. It's not necessarily that the Wildlings want to follow John or they want to fight his wars for him. We know that as a sticking point with them. It's not necessarily mm-hmm. that the Black Brothers want to see him abandon their post. It's just this Ramsey kind of poses an existential threat for all of them.
Right. He could like, come up.
He's going to come and just them. Wipe you yeah. out, which is the worst of all possible circumstances. So it's mm-hmm. like Tyrion's speech about, I don't trust them. I trust their self-interest. I don't have to rationalize why Tormund is going to have to convince, you know, his people to fight for Jon. It's like a self-evident thing that they have to do because yeah. of Ramsay sending this letter. And this, you know, again, here's why Ramsay's not Roose.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean,
sending the letter. Well, we're not anywhere near the letter yet. But
no,
sure.
I know. But I mean, that's okay. What I just want to get that out there. Like, because he's if you're going to do something, just go up there and do it. You got the numbers. Now you've got a chance for these people to get united against you.
I have a crazy tinfoil theory that I want to drop on you later.
Okay, sure.
When we talk about the letter,
you're probably going to be serving up some dry pie to the listeners.
I might, but. It's pretty
tinfoil.
No
Arbor
oil,
Red,
so
just wash it down.
It might just be okay. completely off the reservation.
All right.
We'll see.
I'm excited.
Question here. If John leaves, and it looks like he's going to, what does Ed do with the Black Brothers? Is that like the kind of the last we'll see of them for a while as we go exploring with
it's
John, or
a,
is it...
It's just such a pitiful organization at this point.
Right, right. The and only... they have no chance of holding the wall, like...
I mean, the wall almost could hold... I mean... Yeah, that's all true. I mean, the wall is kind of a formidable thing all to itself. But yeah, like yeah. 48 guys manning it or however many they have at this point. It's just, you know, you don't really want to see John lead all these people away. And even to do something as noble as take back Winterfell. But mm-hmm. I don't know. On the other hand, you don't want to see them all wiped out because that would be, you know, 48 versus 4,000. It's, you know, against the full might of the White Walkers. I don't know, but... But zero is the lowest number you can have, which is what happens
right.
if Bolton's just come up there and clean house.
Yeah, I feel like we might be moving away from the wall for a bit.
That's fine.
Yeah, it's fine by me, too. We've been up there for a very long time.
I mean, I can't imagine what they would, like, if Ed stays up there with his 50 years yeah. So odd and a bunch of sick, old, or very young wildlings... I mean, I guess if, like, he wakes up and there's literally an army of the dead on the other side of the wall.
That's what I was going to say. Next check-in we get is going to be White Walkers,
but,
probably.
But what the hell do they do about that?
Nothing. They die.
So it's like, I don't... You're right. That's a reveal. That's a reveal that eventually is, like, I would expect, like, something crazy to happen. Like, the wall getting knocked down or just a total crushing defeat.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing they can do.
No.
There's nothing that I would... I don't care how many fucking dragon glass arrows they got.
Yeah.
It ain't going to be enough. So
even for what we saw at Hardhome,
yeah.
it's nowhere near enough.
So it's a damn good thing that the White Walkers are taking their time.
Yeah.
Because it seems like they could really take advantage of all this chaos and and wreck shop if they wanted to.
Yep. Okay, let's move on to Davos and Melisandre.
I also want to say something about Sansa here. Is that yeah. this might be the first time since we saw her as a little girl at the beginning of the season where she's just been natural. Like, she's always affected some kind. She's either been terrified under the Lannister's control.
Right.
She's been skeptical and nervous and weird about Littlefinger and his advances and his promises, and then terrified again. Like, it's been a minute since we've seen her. And the last few times we've seen her
be
herself, she was a selfish, spoiled brat little girl.
I feel like there's still a little bit of that in there.
Maybe.
Like, I'm not totally on board with Sansa being Sansa just yet.
But what
it's
I'm saying
take
is
more time for
this
me,
is
but...
the first time we actually have even gotten a chance to
right.
see what her true personality after all these years
yeah.
is at this point. Like, we've seen Jon grow, whereas all of Sansa's growth, she's had to stuff down deep inside and kind of keep within her.
Yeah.
And now it's like springing and uncoiling. But I really like that. And I found myself liking Sansa more and more, not that I ever hated her, but more and more, well, no, that's not true. I pretty much hated Sansa in season one.
Yeah, there was a lot not to like there.
Sure.
But
I couldn't believe how likable and how powerful she was in just the few minutes of screen time she got in this episode, and how much, how great it was to see her with her brother and kind of conspiring revenge.
Yeah, there was something about the playfulness there. So I really liked the playfulness of, of them
together. That felt
together.
Like a brother-sister.
It did, but it also felt a little like she's still a spoiled brat. Like, forgive me, forgive me, forgive me. You're going to forgive me. Do it now. Like, there's a tinge of it that I just can't get on board with. But for the most part, yeah, I'm really warming up to Sansa being a human being instead
That's
of a pawn.
That's interesting, because I feel like that... asking someone to fulfill a need or want is an adult thing to do. Like, there wasn't...
Right,
and also, this is something like, what if we both die tomorrow, or I die? You might feel like, I know you. This is as much for you as much for me. I just want to put all this bad blood and let you know that I was wrong.
Okay, you're reading a lot into that. To me, it felt like her demanding to be forgiven, like a child would.
But I think that's another read into...
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah,
it's just the tone of her voice there.
I can see where you're coming
from.
Irked
me a little bit. But yeah, for the most part, you know, a lot of good stuff with Sansa here. And she gets Jon on the right track in the end. So
yeah,
that's good. Davos asks Melisandre what she's going to do now that she's got Jon leaving. And she says she's going to follow him. The prince who was promised. Apparently that's changed from Stannis to Jon. Davos inquires about what happened at Winterfell. And then Brienne comes up and menaces Melisandre for a minute while explaining that she executed Stannis. And she knows what happened.
And man, I saw in the instant cast, like, it just jumped off, like, how much larger that she is and how intimidating she was naturally. Well, on a second watch, I noticed she walked over there with naked steel. She has her sword out as she's... Yeah, no.
Oh, geez.
And I'm like, that, like, takes it into a whole other direction.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's, like, essentially talking to some tough, scary person and then same person with a loaded gun.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
She's intimidating, but this is... But it's almost like I know and I could snuff both of you out at any time.
Yeah.
Just wanted you to know all of those facts as well.
Right.
And it's just like, when they pan out and she's just sitting there with her long sword out, like, Jesus, that's threatening.
Yep.
And Davos and Melisandre seem somewhat cowed.
Yeah, and it's totally warranted, you know? I mean, she had this oath that Melisandre just totally destroyed by the shadow baby thing, you know, and that kind of sent her spiraling for a long time. And now, like, she's finally got a new mission, and she's over there, you know, I think... I won't say forgive and forget, because she clearly has done neither of those things.
She specifically said, I don't do either of those.
Right, but she is not going to chop Melisandre's head off right now.
Not even yet, though,
you know, because I guess a lot of that died with Stannis, with being able to kill Stannis, because he was kind of the person behind all that, if you want to read it that way.
Yeah, and like, I think, how would Brienne, because I know she made an exception that if... She would accept Lady Stark's service unless it conflicted with her vow to get revenge for Renly's killers. I wonder how exact she interprets that. Like, are people accessories to it, or is it the man who essentially decided on the policy? Is he the one to blame? Because she's ultimately Sansa's lady here.
Yeah.
Her woman at arms, and she doesn't have the freedom to just pursue her revenge willy-nilly. Unless she wants to parse the contract as being like, well, these are also responsible for the death of Renly, so I'm grandfathering them in. I don't know.
Yeah. I could have seen her doing that, but it doesn't seem like she's going to.
No.
She just wants to play some games.
She wants
here.
Them to know.
Yeah.
She wants them to know. She's putting them on blast.
Fine by me. We go over to Robin Arryn. He's practicing his archery when Littlefinger arrives with the bird gift. Royce tries to call out Littlefinger for giving Sansa to the Boltons, but Littlefinger twists him up and demonstrates his manipulative grip over Robin, and he kind of wins the scene here in a big way.
Yeah. There's a lot to say about this scene.
Yeah.
Number one, did you see the image macro on the forums someone whipped up of the Brave Sir Robin character from Monty Python's
No.
Holy Grail?
What is it?
Well, it's like the guy who is always running away, and his bards would sing about how he's bravely running away. And he even has a chicken on his shield, which I thought was a nice homage to the falcon that's on, you know, the house of Arryn.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just funny to me that the both characters called Robin and they're both kind of cowardly putzes.
At least one of his arrows made it to the board. He didn't hit the target, but he hit the board.
That's true. That's true.
He got it far enough.
That's true. But I also thought that this Lord Royce was an interesting character.
Yeah.
And it's like such a weird character quirk that he wears full plate armor essentially all the time. Like almost no one does that. Not even the Kingsguard do. They go around in their leather jerkins most of the time unless they're actually protecting the king. And I wondered if that, you know, kind of like, have you heard of like the Mall Ninja trope? Like the rent-a-cops that take the job just a little too seriously. It's okay. Yeah. Yeah, you might need pepper spray and a radio on your belt, but do you need three pairs of handcuffs and a telescoping baton and, you know, all this other
and
shit?
And they're using code over their walkies.
Yeah. Or like the same thing with like you know, the nerds back in the day with the utility belts. Like, okay, maybe you need a cell phone on there. Okay, yeah, you might need a multi-tool. A pager, I guess, but what the fuck is, like, this multimeter and
a titanium spork? Come on,
yeah,
man.
I don't think you need all that on your belt, dude. Like, do you think that they're trying to suggest that he is a bit of, like, this puffed up? I mean, he literally looks like this puffed up Foghorn Leghorn character in this getup, this full plate. And,
It certainly makes him look, I don't know, the colors and the plate make him look regal to a certain degree, just like.
But he folded like a cheap suit as soon as he realized, you know, he's certainly not as principled as like a Ned, because a Ned would be like, well, you know what? Go fuck yourself. If the Lord wants to execute me,
make
then
me fly,
I'm going to die as a good man rather than, you know, kneel behind but buy all this crap. But I thought that was a really interesting piece of characterization just visually.
Yeah. And it makes me wonder, like this whole scene makes me wonder if this Jon Royce guy is going to step up and try and combat Littlefinger. And in what way could he do that? Because it's apparent that Littlefinger has a vice grip on Robin.
And all of the men are ultimately loyal to Robin, which was also something that I found mildly surprising. But
I mean, I guess they would be if they take their job seriously.
That's the thing, man. That people take this thing about the leader, even if your leader is a doofus young boy.
Yeah. Like, you know, Joffrey
or just weaned from his mama's tit like 2 years ago. Like, you're still, he's the defender of the veil. So, I thought it was a masterful scene of Littlefinger just showing this Royce guy who the real power is. And don't you fucking forget it. Oh, you think that you're going to call me onto the carpet about my double dealings with Sansa? No, fuck you. I'm going to name you as a conspirator and threaten a threat at the Moon Door.
Right.
That's what you thought is going to be the one way, but it's the other way.
And he's almost using this idea of absence makes the heart grow fonder to keep Robin under his spell.
Sure.
Like, he rolls in with fucking gifts once every 5-6 months.
Yeah.
Royce has got to be on his best behavior every single day.
And you can probably tell that. I think that Robin probably catches him rolling his eyes.
Oh, yeah. So that, like, smile when he shot the arrow.
Sure,
bullshit. Sure. Robin knows that.
Like, but Uncle Peter gets me.
Yeah, absolutely.
He gets me. He's
in
been
the
tough,
5 seconds
fair,
I see him every year, he gets me and he brings me fancy stuff.
And
he's going to do anything Littlefinger says. It's genius.
Yes.
Let's move on to Missandei and Grey Worm watching a slaver ship sail in. And they're kind of offended that Tyrion's meeting with the slavers.
Sure.
During the meeting, Tyrion proposes that he will compensate them for their slaves and maybe some other implied stuff that he doesn't spell out, and I wish he would have.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, it's offensive on the face of it to Missandei and Grey Worm for them to be compensated for their production losses.
Yeah.
I mean, that's blood money.
Yeah. And his proposal is that they also need to cease their slaving operations within 7 years and cut off their support for the Sons of the Harpy.
Yeah.
I don't know what you want to say about this meeting. Do you want to continue with the rest of this scene? Because it's kind of a two-parter here.
Yeah, sure. Then we can talk about these maneuverings as a unit, sure.
Okay. So we go to the throne room. There are some former slaves who are angry that Tyrion's meeting with their former masters and has made peace with them. They don't like finding that out. and they appeal to Grey Worm and Missandei, who reluctantly back Tyrion's strategy there in front of them. But then once they're outside, they argue with Tyrion, and Grey Worm leaves him with the warning that the Masters are not to be trusted.
And everyone is right and has a point here.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I think after multiple watchings, Tyrion's is essentially, we have to have, because we are not in a position to protect this city, and if I lose the Queen's City, then we have nothing.
Right.
So I need to bide time and form alliances, and maybe this stuff works out, but if not, give us the time to build up our strength and build up our alliances to the point where we are strong enough to stand on our own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the similar situation with the Wise Masters. They think they could probably retake Meereen if they had to, but man, those Unsullied and all those dragons, like, they're kind of circling each other. So now is the time to try to wring concessions. And I do feel like by the time you get to the end of the episode, now that Dany has presumably 100,000 Dothraki warriors, that these people are going to rue the day they didn't take whatever deal Tyrion handed down.
Yeah, I don't know if they haven't taken it. It's not super clear as to where it's left. But I do agree with Tyrion's strategy, but he also does need the guidance of Missandei and Grey Worm and to take into account the people here.
The thing that really struck me as, ooh, when I was watching it again is when he sent in the four, what surely were formerly slave girls.
Yeah.
Who are now, if you want to charitably say, they're independent contractors, they're prostitutes. And he asked for volunteers. Hey, who wants to get really well paid to sleep with these Wise Masters as a way to sweeten the deal? And he only took volunteers. It's still, like, if you're sitting there as Missandei, that's gross.
Sure.
Like, that is terribly disgraceful and not something you want to see your fellow country women being not forced, coerced, whatever. I mean, and that's the other thing is, like, if these people were slaves 6 weeks ago, like, you can really have an argument about whether the way they see this relationship is a natural thing or it's something they've been conditioned to accept, and what does their free will even mean at this point? Like, should they be able to make these decisions? I mean, there's a lot of debate to be had there, but clearly it affects Missandei.
Absolutely, and Grey Worm as well. I mean, he doesn't trust these guys, and he shouldn't.
Right, but like everything that Tyrion says about them being underestimated as an advantage, and the fact that war is a whore that should be ended today, and slavery is a whore, and you can...
Can't do either, really. But,
right.
But both is completely
And then Grey Worm's
the
like, these people use people. That's what they do. Like, he's not wrong about that, too. I mean, it's just... I think that we as a viewer tend to trust Tyrion because we know how smart he is.
Well, I also trust Tyrion because he's... Look, as much as I love a principled stand, and it feels very good in the moment watching it, it has consequences. I mean, look at Ned, look at the shit that Dany has brought down on this city. It's like, you can take a principled stand, but there are consequences to pay, and Tyrion is riding the line, right? Tyrion does have this principle in mind, but he's willing to use other means to get it other than just flat-out refusal to comply.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they need in this moment. And that's the thing that really has me on Tyrion's side, is he kind of gets it from all angles. He gets the political maneuvering, he gets the idea that slavery is bad, and the idea that they want to conquer this idea.
Right.
I'm on board. I'm totally on board with Tyrion, but I do think he needs to have his head be pointed in the right direction by the people who have more stake in this.
Because that's the thing, is that we know that he's not really plugged into the culture and the heart of this, the people.
Yeah.
And he needs to do that to effectively lead. So yes, they're essentially telling him what the streets of Meereen are going to be saying tomorrow.
Yeah.
And also what the larger council of these former slaves are going to say as well. So that's all about, and he can't, you know, like you said, well, I was a slave too, her. I mean, that's reminding me of, like, the thing on John Oliver where the one Norwegian girl, immigration person who's, like, taking the stand against, like, she jumped in to the Mediterranean Sea, I think, or was it, with this giant flotation suit, and she floated there for, like, 5 seconds within arm's reach of a boat and said, oh, yeah, now I know how people coming to us over the seas feel. It's like, no, you fucking don't.
No. You didn't get a true taste.
Get washed off of that with the clothes on your back and stay there for a few hours and not have any boat in sight. That's what it feels like to be abandoned in the middle of the...
Right, and be told we're not coming back for you.
Yeah, like, you know, Tyrion got a small taste of what these people lived. So all that stuff was really good.
And I wonder if, like you mentioned with the former slaves, could this backfire on him? Could it be that the slaves don't see what he's doing and they don't see the wisdom in it, and now they're against him as well? Because it certainly felt like that in the throne room there.
Yeah, yeah. No, he could pay... I mean, he could pay too steep a price and lose the city the other way.
Right. So Civil War. I mean, you want to talk about King's Landing.
And also he's got...
Talk about Marine.
He's got to answer to when Dany comes back.
Yeah.
Like, he better have something that she believes in and doesn't think he pissed away, like, what she thought was right and didn't take the principled stand.
Yeah.
But that's it's so refreshing.
I've always felt like her strategy has been kind of dumb, though. Like, that principled stand is fine and well for your heart,
yeah,
but it oftentimes doesn't win the day.
Well, you've got the
pragmatist
and not an idealist, and she's very much an idealist.
Well, but that's what I mean. Like, you need to be somewhat
pragmatist
to lead. Yeah, and to win these battles of hearts.
Unless you have the ability to, like, you know, wave a magic wand and make the world inform.
Which she just might.
What I'm saying. Yeah. That's the thing about her being an idealist, is she just might have the power to remake the world in the image. She could break the wheel, as she said last season.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where it's like, well, yeah, if you weren't the mother of dragons, you wouldn't get away with this. It's just nice and refreshing to see in your entertainment where people have substantive disagreements, where no one is just, you know, oh, well, you got the idiot ball this week, Grey Worm, so you make some bullshit emotional thing that's based on nothing and out of your character. It's nice to see that.
Yeah.
So, and also it's nice to see scheming and politicking back in Game of Thrones.
Absolutely.
With people that are good at playing it.
Tyrion, like, yeah.
Tywin's been dead. Tyrion's been exiled. Right. Olenna's been kind of on the outs. We've had scenes kind of Cersei and Dany, both ineptly at the wheel of state. And it's nice to see kind of
and
like...
And High Sparrow, who I
the High
have
Sparrow,
a revulsion
sure,
for. Like,
sure. He's playing... But he was playing checkers with a bunch of three-year-olds.
And Ilaria, like...
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to see people doing their thing with skill.
Right.
Even Cersei is like, I don't know if this is going to be a reflection of what book Cersei becomes, but holy shit, when she's doing her thing later on, she seems very smart and competent and pragmatic.
Yeah.
And like, maybe she was paying attention to Tywin all those years.
Maybe.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
You know what's not fun to see? Jorah and Daario continue to especially Daario, continue to be a real shit about this Danny thing. Like, why? Why do you got to rub it in, man? We've got an mission here. Just
wasn't disciplined as a child.
Let it be. He wasn't. He needs to be disciplined now.
Which I don't buy.
Here's the thing. If you don't want to fight Jorah, shut your fucking mouth. Like, because you're instigating, right? As much as Cersei doesn't want to instigate the High Sparrow... Or Tommen doesn't want to instigate the High Sparrow. Jorah, come, leave Jorah alone.
But if Jorah attacked him, and I mean, I think he's protesting a bit too much. Because number one, if he was raised in the slave pits of wherever, there's no fucking way he didn't get disciplined. Every single time he was annoying shit, he probably got the taste smacked out of his mouth at best.
Yeah.
So that's bullshit. Number two, I think he would like to provoke Jorah in a fight because he's seen Jorah puff and huff up this hill. If Jorah draws down on him and he kills him, he's, you know, to put in Raylan Givens terms, justified, then what the fuck can Danny say? And he's just eliminated this annoying
rival.
Oh,
it's not about Danny. It's about his popular opinion of Daario, right? Like, if I kill you, I'm the shit who killed
an old
man.
But I'm saying, I'm just saying that I think Dario's, he doesn't give a shit about what people think of him.
Probably not.
If he did, then he wouldn't betray his old comrades and deliver his heads to Danny.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Well, of course, that was a different Daario, literally. and the other thing is, like, some of this discussion feels foolish because by the end of the episode, I think he's yet again a different Daario. Like, he's a like what Jorah said about him, like, I'm sad that she chosen you because you're just going to use her and get tired of her and not be there for her. I don't know that that's true anymore. I think Daario is Saul on the road to Damascus situation. The scales have fallen from his eyes and he sees Dany for what she is, which is, like, I mean, he was saying it before, but I think he feels it now. Like, this is a special woman who could be this great leader.
Yeah, he literally sees it.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It's hard to ignore. Let me describe the scene real quick. So they're continuing their search for Danny. They spot the Dothraki city and shed their weapons so they can blend in. During the process of getting rid of their weapons, Daario notices Jorah's grayscale, which I'm assuming is going to come into play later. They sneak into the city, but they're spotted by a couple Dothraki, and then they pretend to be traitors, but Dothraki aren't buying it. Not one bit. And they have to kill both of these guys.
Holy shit, that's a lot of scenes we were just recapped. So the one thing I
want
to talk
about... Yeah, it's kind of a long string of...
One thing I want to talk about is I think the show's intentionally showing us that Jorah has lost a step.
Because I immediately knew that he kept that knife. Like, there was no surprise there whatsoever.
Oh, no. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about Jorah's huffing and puffing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
His
and
getting
he gets
that.
His ass
admittedly,
kicked.
This guy is a much larger, much younger man.
Yeah.
But we saw Jorah mow down arenas full of professional fighters. I think this...
Mow down? I mean, he was saved... Wasn't he saved?
I'm talking about how
by...
he got to there. He mowed down, and then he was doing well, and, you know, he was winning in the pits. What I'm saying is that I wonder if they're suggesting this grayscale is costing him a physical toll. He's not the same Jorah...
Could be.
...that was able to defeat Dothraki in single combat, was able to win in pit fights against professional fighters...
Mm-hmm.
And certainly couldn't beat Daario at this point. And also, thank you, Dario, for not being a total dumbass and bringing a blade into the city.
Yeah.
Because I was, the whole time I was thinking, like, yeah, you might be right, but you might not have to fight 100,000 Dothraki. You might have to fight two or three in a dark alley. And then, like, yeah. Seconds after I had that thought, that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
So thank God that he actually hid a dagger on him.
I was not fooled. I don't know if anybody was, but well, God, it was so transparent. Jorah turns his back at the end, and he's like, "I'll do it myself."
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Come on.
Good call on you, because I didn't catch that at first. But also, like, yeah, I get in that jingle jangling with your long swords and your stuff at your side, but yeah, have a dagger. That's such a huge advantage if you're infiltrating. You know.
Yep.
Whatever.
Just don't tuck the dagger into the front of your pants. Like some people tuck guns in the front of their pants.
Mm.
It's a bad idea, especially with a dagger.
Mm-hmm.
You get all sliced up down there. Like with a gun, it's only bad if it goes off. But
see, someone put in, I don't know if they're joking or being serious, but when Grey Worm's walking around, you can see like he's got like a, you know, a cock and ball bulge in the front of his pants.
Oh, you got to tape that shit down.
Well, that's what someone is saying. I'm like, well, maybe he's just hiding his favorite dagger, like Dario, in the one place where people won't expect it.
His cock-shaped dagger? Is that what he's got?
Well, Dario's got a woman-shaped dagger.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Why not? Why not? That's
I mean.
Crazy. He stole from a cock merchant.
It's a dwarf cock shaped dagger?
No, it's more of a Tormund.
No. Oh, okay.
But no, I'm just saying. I thought that was nice. I also loved the failed pocket sand trick.
Right.
That was so fucking funny.
Guy just looks at him like, missed. Do you think that was going
to
work?
Like, I was going to take it to the cows. Now I'm just going to beat your ass to death. And then Dario right. comes in.
I've seen Bloodsport. I was ready for that.
And then the fact that Dario thought to smash his head in with a rock to cover up his stab wound, which I thought, I wonder if that will work. And then when they see later on the cows seen debating, and I'm like, man, these guys are a bunch of idiots. Yeah, they just don't care. And I think that's something we're supposed to understand about them. But we can talk about that when we get there.
There's a lot of reasons to want them to die. But yeah, we'll get there. Danny listens to the eldest of the widows, the Dothraki widows here, go on about Dothraki bloodlines and some other bullshit, and then leaves with one of the younger widows to make water.
Mm-hmm.
But she really just wants some fresh air. And then Jorah and Dario find her, and she comes up with a plan on the fly that we don't see until later, until it's executed.
I thought it was interesting how, like, you know, Dario sees the Dothraki drinking and fucking. He's like, oh, I should have been born a Dothraki, and then this Dosh Kaleen is essentially a cautionary tale for anybody like fucking Dario that would glorify the Dothraki culture. Because sure, there's the love of battle and the casual attitude towards sex, and I guess they're nominally a matriarchy, but then the whole thing is built on a platform of thievery and rape. So,
sure,
yeah,
as a lot of. You know, older civilizations were.
But I'm just saying that, like, I think there's a lot of romanticizing of the Dothraki, and like, you know, pump the brakes on that. Maybe they need new leadership.
Yeah, I guess I'm not on board with the Dothraki train. Like, so much of their culture and their, I don't know if it's just so hard to know, like, to memorize all these names and to really understand their culture for me.
Mm-hmm.
That I gloss over it like I would with any fantasy type shit. But I'm just, you know, I see the Dothraki as bloodthirsty raiders, and that's kind of it. I haven't really delved into the depths of
Dothraki
culture.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate science fiction fantasy trope. It's like, you know, when you show Klingons on Star Trek, it's you don't ever get to see the Klingon who's the sensitive poet. They're all fucking bloodthirsty warrior.
Worf. He's battling against his human nature.
Sure, but then again, he's seen as lesser a Klingon because of those things when he gets
absolutely.
The real Klingon. So, I mean...
But I just mean, like, all of this is so many wheelbarrows.
Sure.
Mounted up on top of each other, and
they're
I just at some
top
point
of tropes,
go...
tropes, writing tropes.
I can't keep it all straight, and I'm not deep enough in this culture, so I'll, you know, just forget all of it. But I'm sure you have a better grasp on Dothraki. I don't even know the names of these people, like...
I don't either. They're all dead. And there's the two important ones will probably, you know, It's the old right. Dosh Killeen and the young Dosh Killeen to me.
Dosh Killeen. Like, what is Dosh Killeen? Can you explain that?
Yeah,
for
so like
some
all
people?
The all of the widows me of the mostly. Cows go to the capital city. That's why I say they're nominally a matriarchy, because they have some great religious and spiritual and advisory power, and that you can tell that the right. cows are deferential to them, and there's like rules of conduct and things you can't do. But on the other hand, I think we're seeing in this season is that how much of that power is real, because the cows get to pick all their targets. Like, if sure. Dosh Killeen's only power is you can't bring swords in their cities and they can use, like, have a woman eat a horse heart and give a prophecy that may be meaningless.
So the Dosh Killeen are the widows
yes.
of the cows? Okay.
Yeah, that's like that ruling council. But I'm starting to speculate, like, how much do they really rule?
But then there's a council, an actual council that comes together to decide what
that's
to do
what
with
I'm
Danny,
saying.
Which is made up of cows. Like,
that's what I'm
what
saying.
What is that called?
That
do you know the name for that?
I forget that it's essentially a Grand Khalasar.
Okay.
But it's like, I don't know what they called it either, but it's like a
right.
cow moot.
the words are so foreign to me and the culture is so foreign, I just can't get my head around
it's
it.
Burning Man. Burning Cow.
Yeah.
Burning Cow.
Pretty much.
29, or 2000, or 298.
Oh, man. So we go over to Marjorie, whose situation I do understand a little bit better. She's taken to see the High Sparrow. He tells some long, stupid story about how he gave up his successful cobbling business and turned to religion because his friends looked terrible naked and they smelled bad. Then he takes her to see her brother, Loris, and she tells him to stay strong, but it doesn't look like he's going to be able to.
I don't know. I mean, this guy seems like the kind of sexually repressed religious political leader that is almost like, you know, a joke in America at this point. Like,
right.
Because he was talking about, like, what he's doing. I'm like, okay, well, I don't know how you feel about prostitution, but charging a fair price for a quality product. I mean, he's essentially...
Right. He's...
It's like I've suddenly am disgusted and repulsed by my deep-seated loathing of myself, and now I'm going to force everyone to have this same thing that I organically had this call to faith.
Right, it's
but
like,
I'm going
it's like
to
a
force
minister.
Everyone at pain of hammer to have the same epiphany.
Yeah, it's like a minister who realizes that he's gay and then doubles down on the truth.
Like, as he was talking about the details of the women and the wine, you could almost see him salivating. Like, he wants
right.
that so bad, but he...
And I don't know why he's equating riches with sin. Like, there's nothing inherent about being wealthy that is sinful.
Sure.
He seems to think like the natural state of humanity is
about
to be
power
poor.
That is corrupt either, but like
I that's
mean,
what I mean. Like yeah. would he say the same about like Danny? Would he say the same about other people who are in power who are not Loris, who are not
sure? No,
like,
I feel like this is all intentional allegory.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is why I think he's a ridiculous character.
Yeah.
Like his philosophies are ridiculous. His
It
methods are ridiculous.
More
I
and
mean,
more like this is a piece of marketing than it is a genuine person.
Yeah. I don't know. And I will admit, I have a reflexive dislike
yep.
of this character,
you can admit
given
our biases,
my history and my experience in life. So I can see why people would maybe defend this guy a little bit more than I would. But.
Sure. Sure.
And, you know, we get the title here, Book of the Stranger. That's apparently the Bible of this religion,
mm-hmm.
the Quran, the
well,
Torah of this religion.
That's the book of the seven-pointed star, which is the Bible of the culture. The book, it's called the seven-pointed
right.
star.
Book,
this is
book
the,
of the
stranger's book, yeah.
Right, this is a chapter. This is like...
Or, like, yeah, I guess you got the books of the Bible, and the seven-pointed star is the canon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
I'm being pedantic.
Is there any...
You can tell
right,
me to go fuck
you
myself.
Definitely are. Go fuck yourself.
Thank you.
Is there any greater relevance here for the title of this episode? Do you see, I don't know, perhaps cobblers abandoning their way of life? Perhaps sin equated as riches? Like, where are we going with this?
Because
normally a title doesn't just describe a scene.
I don't know. If I want to be cheeky, I'd say there is a reference to a spiritual change after walking through a graveyard. That's interesting.
Right.
I also think that There's a couple emailers because, you know, we are famous for playing the name game. Tried to make, but I didn't include them because it's just kind of a stretch. But they're like, you could look at Sansa and Jon reuniting as kind of like they've always been strangers. And
But I think it's less literal.
I don't think this title
is literally about strangers. It's about that principle.
Yeah.
That's quoted in the book of the Stranger.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, let's go to the High Council.
Wait a second. Did we talk about meeting her brother?
Her meeting her brother.
Yeah.
I mentioned that it happens.
Okay, so I want to talk about that because we were kind of puzzled, or we didn't really puzzled, but we were kind of talking about like what all that meant. And as I've seen it more, it seems clear to me that the High Septon intended that Margaery would help break Loras. Or that Margaery thought that she was, like, you know, pretending to be moved by this, and she came in and she's trying to pump her brother up. Right. But the High Sparrow realized he already had broken Loras, and he was going to break Margaery with Loras. She thought the one thing, and it was actually the other situation. And I thought that was kind of pretty interesting political maneuvering by him.
All right, so we move on to Pycelle counseling Tommen on how to handle this High Sparrow situation. When Cersei strolls up to talk to Tommen, Tommen says they can't put Margaery at risk by antagonizing the High Sparrow, but Cersei says the High Sparrow needs to be taught a lesson in respect, and Tommen says that he promised the High Sparrow he wouldn't tell anyone something that we don't see.
Who's playing who here, Jim?
Everybody's playing everybody. I mean,
because
it's the Game of Thrones.
Anytime you have someone saying, I'm not supposed to tell you something, but that seems like it's a boon for the person hearing it.
Right.
But do you think the High Sparrow is smart enough to know that he's going to run back and tell his mother, and he's setting a trap for them to do what they're going to do, which is try to massively overreach against this popular movement?
I think he could be. I certainly would give him enough credit on his strategy.
He does seem shrewd for a shoemaker.
Yep. Yep.
That doesn't wear shoes. I'm on to you, High Sparrow.
Right. I mean, he said he walked out without his shoes. Didn't even take his shoes. Never worn shoes since.
Nope.
Yeah, I think
you know what? That's the thing. It's not about the whores and the wine. It was just burning out.
Right.
You've made your 100th shoe, and it's like, you know what? Fuck this.
I put 12 weeks into these shoes. I got a silver piece?
Yeah, this is not working out, man.
Yeah.
I'm going to go podcast.
No, apparently he was affluent. I think it was all the stink of his friends. It was just like, oh, God, these people.
If only he hung out with more attractive people that were more into cleanliness, this never would have happened.
Yeah.
It's the butterfly flaps that cause a typhoon in Westeros.
But yeah, certainly he's playing a deeper game, as he always is. It's up to Cersei to kind of figure it out. And is she going to? Because she immediately then goes to the High Council or the Small Council with Jaime to get things back on track. And she says that Margaery can't be allowed to make her Walk of Atonement, which causes Olenna to perk up and listen because she's on board with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jaime tells Kevin, look, you're going to stand down. The Tyrell army show up and capture or kill the High Sparrow, and you will not have disobeyed the king.
And so, also, even if you did, if the end result is the Sparrows are gone, Margaery's back in his bed.
Tommen's not going to care.
Tommen isn't going to be like, good job, uncle.
Right. He's going to be too busy with a marathon fuck session.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
He's not even going to notice.
He won't come out of his chambers for days.
Right.
I think that's pretty interesting. But so I thought on second watch, there is an interesting thing. I noticed that, like, there was a little bit of a twinkle in Lady Olenna's eyes about, you know, when Cersei was essentially saying, oh, your troops are going to stand down and let my armies into this city, and we're established rivals. Huh, okay, this is a nice unexpected opportunity for me to seize.
Right.
But the music, which I guess I interpret, I mean, that's all the editors and that's the showrunner's choices, right? The music started playing The Reigns of Castamere underneath this dialogue, which implies that this is a Lannister revenge. Is that the Double D's, you know, zigging where we're expecting him to zagging? Or am I correct that Lady Olenna is going to try to capitalize on this? Is there some way that this is a trap to Cersei? Because I thought that Cersei was pretty amazing in this scene when she's like, you know, the High Sparrow seized power and knew we'd bicker among ourselves rather than seize the power back.
Yes.
Here we are. well done to us. Like, kind of like, you think I'm the idiot, but you guys have played the game too.
We're all idiots.
Yes. Right. We're
Let's
all
come together.
Idiots.
Let's put our idiot heads together and figure this thing out.
Sure. Sure.
And put our idiot swords together, most importantly. Yeah, I think this could be, there could be a lot of opportunities for double crossing. I think the Tyrells could say, hey, we've got an army in here, like you said. Let's do this thing and take King's Landing for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The other way it could go, Olenna mentions this civil war that could happen if we kill the High Sparrow,
yeah.
Right? And they might have to squash that. But I see an opportunity for Cersei to blame all of the goings-on on the Tyrells, because Kevin Lannister at this point will have stepped down, will have said, I want no part of this. The yeah. Tyrells will have forcibly brought their armies in and killed the High Sparrow. She can point the finger and say, these are the people you should be angry at.
Or if it fails, here, she can say, hey, High Sparrow, it wasn't our
right.
troops that was in it. It was all
right.
these guys. So, yeah, that's...
Which is understandable. You're holding their daughter.
And also, they established that the Lannisters have the largest army.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, like, what, because that's the other thing I'm wondering. And some people want us to talk about, like, the relative military standings of everybody left on the board. And
it'd be nice, at least in King's Landing.
Well, so we heard the Boltons have 5,000.
Right.
But we don't know how many troops we have in the Vale, although that's kind of like one of the kingdoms that never threw in. We don't know how big of an army that the Martells have down in Dorne, although, and they're kind of
right.
an unspoiled army.
Wildlings are like 2,000.
And the Tyrells kind of were the mop-up force. They never really did a lot of heavy wars in the War of the Five Kings. So, like, maybe they're... But the Lannisters still have the biggest force. So it's like, are we talking 20, 30,000? With the Tyrells being 15, 20, and the Boltons being 5? And it would be nice to know how many pieces we have on the board at this point.
It would be, yeah. Because I don't have a good sense of how strong the Lannister army is.
No.
At this point, it honestly feels like they've just got Robert the Strong and the Kingsguard, and that's pretty much it. But we
sure.
know that they have a lot more,
yeah,
in reserve. But yeah, I do see a lot of opportunities for double cross on both sides here. So it'll be interesting to see how this battle plays out, not only with the High Sparrow and the people of King's Landing, but also between the Tyrells and the Lannisters.
Sure.
Let's move on to Theon. He's on the Iron Islands. He's speaking with Yara, who rakes him over the guilt coals, wants nothing to do with him, until he promises that he doesn't want to be king, and instead he wants to actually help her become queen, whatever, and rule.
Yeah, I like the scene. I just don't know how Theon helps, because, maybe she keeps him as a behind-the-scene advisor, but he's no Tyrion.
No.
Like I mentioned on the instant cast, I kind of saw him as this, you know, dandy that didn't have any real experience and was full of swagger and self-importance, but had nothing really to back it up with.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that his political insights have gotten sharper after he got broken by Ramsay Bolton. So I don't know what he brings to the table other than emotional support, and he's kind of emotionally unstable.
Great.
Right? So it's like, and also if he's like publicly supporting her, assuming the Iron Islands know about, you know, him having his favorite toy taken away, I wonder what the Iron Islanders would think of that. I don't think anything good. I think they're very much would be of the opinion that if you are minus cock and balls, that you're no man at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a political liability.
Yeah, I hypothesized in the instant take, I wonder if he has some kind of sway during this King's Moot thing. I know you can't really talk about it, but what
I can't talk
throwing...
about it because Theon is not this is a remix that all this
oh,
stuff.
That's
yeah,
right.
That's what I'm saying, like this
right.
is completely kind. It's not completely off. The characters have been shuffled up, and I don't know what's going to happen.
I just wonder if him throwing his hat in the ring during the King's Moot for Yara would actually do anything for her. Would give her some sort of extra claim.
It just depends if the other
whoever
iron,
else
if the Iron Islanders know that he is unmanned. I think that it would not. If they don't know, then that's probably something they pay attention to.
Really? So his bloodline without minus cock and balls means nothing?
I don't think it means nothing, but that does seem to be the way of the people. Is that they? It's not even necessarily a hereditary thing. It's you know, who can make the best claim for the throne. It's a weirdly democratic system.
Okay. Strange.
I mean, it's a kleptocracy. It's more of than a democracy, but you know, that's they're again, it's like the Dothraki. They're literally a nation of pirates.
Yeah.
So,
and I can't say enough. This is the scene that really did it for me in this episode. Mm-hmm. This moment between Yara and Theon here. I have since the instant cast looked up the woman who plays Yara. Her name's Gemma. I guess that's how you pronounce it. Gemma Whalen.
Mm-hmm.
And she's incredible. Alfie Allen in this scene, incredible. I think those two play really well off each other.
Yeah.
And I was just enthralled by this scene.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I just, the thing is that kept me from making it as awesome, like putting up there with like the Jon and Sansa scenes, is just I don't, with them I see like not only is this awesome reunion, but I definitely see where this is going and it's awesome. The Greyjoy stuff, I'm like, yeah, it's an awesome reunion scene, but I don't immediately see how this is going to pan out. So it's slightly less exciting. But it, yeah, you're
okay,
right. It's
I guess I don't care.
It's like, you're right. It's executed at a very high artistic level, and that should be good enough for me.
And emotional level. Like, yeah, Theon comes back. My God, Theon's, as much as he was destroyed during all the shit he went through with Ramsay and then Sansa, like, it's twice as
he's
much
got that
here
Canadian
with his
thing where it's like, sorry, stop saying that, sorry, you know, like, he can't stop. It's,
yes,
it's reflexive
Iron
at
Islanders,
this point.
The Greyjoys, the Canadians of Westeros. So we go over to Ramsay, who invites Asha into his chambers for some sexy time. Kind of, actually, to just feel her out. Actually, just to kill her. I mean, let's be honest. He knows what he's doing here before he even gets into it.
Yeah.
He's questioning her about her loyalty, but it's all a ruse. It's all a sham.
Too soon. Don't be mentioning ruse.
Asha attempts to...
The Dreadfort's still mourning.
She attempts to use his paring knife to kill him, but instead he kills her, revealing that he knew exactly who she was all along and what she had done, thanks to Theon's confession during his torture.
So, my big question is, I thought when I was watching this that this was a very transparent effort by Asha, even...
Yeah.
In hindsight, knowing that Ramsay knew. And my question is, was this intended to be shown as transparent, or was this a slightly off execution? And is the fact that I'm mentally debating this, meaning that is an incredible execution that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the way, like she was like, I've seen her do this more effectively. Of course, again, Theon's kind of an idiot. He probably should have seen it coming the other way, too.
I think it was well executed. I mean, we know from the outset that Asha is there to kill him, right? The way she looks at that knife as
well,
he sets it down.
What I mean is, like, I feel like that it wasn't as transparent, and this is why I think this is all intentionally. When she walks into the room and he's peeling the apple, flaying the apple.
Right, exactly.
And she says, you know, do you eat them afterwards after you flay them? And he goes, no. He's like, well, then I've seen worse, which is a reference that we know through the Thins and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Her as a, you know, a wildling and what all she's seen north of the wall. I felt like that was all working, but there was a point where it seems like she kind of knew that he was cottoning on to her, and there was a little bit of a desperation to her performance because he kept on calling out things like, and she was, you know, like, oh, you hated the Starks, eh? Why were you defending Rickon? And she's like, oh, well, I could get a fetch a fair price for him.
I mean, this is just Ramsay playing his games. He already knows the outcome of this.
I know, but what I'm saying is I felt like her performance degraded as it became aware of the possibility in her mind that Ramsay was ready for her. That's, and it's really not
even, I feel
even
like that wasn't even a possibility in her mind until she had the knife in her neck. Like,
I took it as, because I thought that she's capable of giving a better performance, but she was rattled. Or maybe she just wasn't executing from an acting and directing standpoint, but I'm more inclined to go with the former.
All right.
And it's weird. Cause
I guess I didn't see any of that.
So I could just be crazy.
Okay.
That's always a possibility. I could be reading, after watching this three times, I could be reading too much into these moments.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's... We know so much about this scene going into it that it's everything is transparent to us. So how much are we supposed to be on board with what Asha is doing, and how much are we supposed to understand what Ramsay is doing?
Yeah, and I saw a lot of people reiterating how tired they are of seeing Ramsay killing people, but I feel like that
he needed to at this point. Like
with Asha being like, if you're going to introduce Asha at all, then she had this having her be alive would string us along thinking that she, because a lot of people last week are like, oh, she's going to Theon everybody and assassinate everybody and the North remembers all that kind of
right.
stuff.
No, let's put the kibosh on that immediately.
Yeah, but also there's so many things arrayed against Ramsay. We know that the wildlings are uniting with Jon and Sansa's wanting him to reunite the Northern lords and Littlefinger's marching from the Vale. Like your time's up, bastard.
Yeah,
so
can't wait to see that.
Yeah, so I felt like it is a little bit more tolerable just because you see the writing on the wall for him being finished.
Yeah,
so like enjoy your killings while you can,
enjoy your classic asshole eating an apple scene. Like
right.
There's no better way to show someone's an asshole than have them eat an apple, and that's what they do here.
Yep,
classic JJ Abrams move.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
A letter
from... Oh, they
from...
read that from the Bible. You know, Eve eats the apple, things fall to shit.
Eve, the proto-asshole.
You can't get any more back in history than that, can you, Joe? Creation of the world.
Arguably. Let's move on to a letter from the Boltons arriving at Castle Black. We immediately know it's from the Boltons. We don't need to see the seal. We see the shield. John reads it. He says... it says, hey, we've got Rickon, and his skin is looking oh so good for peeling. Give me back Sansa, or we'll come do some nasty things to you. I'm paraphrasing here. Sansa seizes the opportunity to talk Jon into agreeing to take back Winterfell. And he does agree, but they can't quite do it with the 2,000 wildlings who can fight. So who knows where they're going to get their other armies, but he's on the warpath at least. He's on board with Sansa's goal of taking back Winterfell.
Yeah. I like this scene. This was a, you know, it's slightly reshuffling of the events and facts from the final book.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the fact that some people pointed out in the subreddits that this lyrical structure of I'm going to tell you something awful that happens and then come and see is echoed in the Book of Revelations when they're opening up the seven seals of judgment against the earth and the sea. And after each seal is opened and something awful happens, like the sun is blotted out or a plague of locusts or the, you know, beast comes and walks the earth, the angel always says, come and see. So
okay.
Do you think that was a deliberate aping of the... It could give it kind of like that condemnatory Old Testament, well, I guess it would be New Testament, you know, ring to it? Like...
Yeah, I mean, with the title of the show, this episode being kind of a biblical
reference, sure.
The sort of Westerosi Seven Gods book of the Bible. Yeah, yeah, I could see that.
And I like how Sansa won't let Jon off the hook and equivocate, because she sees, like, Tormund, like, as much as he was gnawing on that chicken bone and looking at Brienne, he's now intently looking at Jon reading this letter. Like, this is getting his blood boiling, and John's wanting to let off the gas when she's like, nope, we need to read this whole fucking thing into the record. Yeah. I want all this stuff ringing in their ears when they go back to discuss the wisdom of joining forces with us, and shows that
Absolutely.
She's a much, much more natural politician than John is.
It makes me like, so let me say two words. We can cut this if you need to, but pink letter.
Okay.
That's what this letter is called, yes?
In the books, yeah.
In the books.
Because it's sealed in like a pink wax.
Can we talk about that at all? Here's where my tinfoil theory comes in, because I don't know about the pink letter. All I know is it is a letter that John receives that incites him to do, whatever
what
he's going
to
do. The Winterfell gambit. Is there any chance that this actually isn't from the Boltons? Could this be from Littlefinger? Because Littlefinger has had access to the Boltons, has had access to, you know, whatever the wax seal thing is called. I forget the name of that.
The signet ring or whatever.
Sure. He could potentially have that in his possession. Is there any chance that he wants a clash at Winterfell before he gets there?
It's funny, because there was a lot of speculation on who the author of the pink letter was in the books, because that's kind of, you know, obviously it's a letter. It's not Ramsay himself coming forth and telling them these things. And a lot of the popular speculation was that Stannis sent it, because he was trying to, as a last-ditch effort, to get Jon to get out of, you know, bring his wildlings down and bail his ass out. He's dead in the show. Another popular theory was that Roose was tired of his son.
We know that's not true.
And he was trying to provoke this and the happening, and Roose is dead. So, like, I don't know that Littlefinger got a lot of play in the books, or if that's because his plot is way far kind of advanced from where we left him in the books, but...
Okay.
It does make sense. If he wants to march with the Vale and get there kind of at the same time, why not join forces with Jon's army and, you know, kind of do it at half the personal cost to yourself?
Right.
And then now, what is his play for Sansa?
Well, Sansa could have been a long con, right? He could have hoped that Jon would hear about it, hoped that Ramsay would make a mistake, and Jon would come marching south with some armies and help destroy the Boltons. That didn't happen, clearly. Sansa got away, and now she's north. Maybe this is a second attempt.
Yeah, and how does this help Littlefinger's position? Because it puts...
Well, it would hurt the Bolton armies. I don't know how many armies, how many men or people Littlefinger has at this moment, but 5,000 is nothing to sneeze at, especially in a siege scenario.
Well, and he did promise a young man to
Olenna, yeah.
And is that...
Was it Olenna?
Or was it to Cersei?
No, it was Olenna.
Okay, that's
what
I thought
so too. His brothel.
Is this a long con to marry off Robin to Margaery? Like, explain the twinkle in Olenna's eye?
The long con. Can you extrapolate, like, how would that work?
Like, essentially, they're going to team up together to overthrow the Lannisters with the understanding that Margaery, once again, will be married off to yet another.
So he's consolidating the forces of the North. Through you know,
yes,
weakening
the
Bolton
march
armies,
in there
he's
going
to take Winterfell.
And Sansa, the only thing is, I don't know what Sansa thinks of Littlefinger at this point. I think that she's going to be smart enough to see through his bullshit.
Yeah.
And maybe that's his underestimating her is what's going to be his downfall.
Could be.
But, yeah, I mean, in his mind, I see, if I grant you your tinfoil theory, that it's Littlefinger writing
And it's as tinfoil as it gets, and it's not very well supported.
Well, I mean, because as I said, it's stupid on the face of for Ramsay to write this letter, because he's giving away the element of surprise, and he's also inflaming.
But that's kind
attention.
Of also in character.
Yes, you're
so,
right.
Yeah.
But that's why it's such a beautiful piece of tinfoil.
Yes,
Littlefinger gains the fact that Sansa and Jon and Rickon are going to feel grateful that he's helped them in their war.
Sure.
Which solidifies...
Especially if he gives them Winterfell.
It solidifies his influence over the North, and also makes sure... It essentially keeps him as the Warden of the East, or the Warden of the Vale. It cements his position there. Maybe he can suggest that Robin and Sansa get married, which would further solidify. I mean, I don't know, like, how far down the line do you want me to try to anticipate, but there's definitely some advantages for him. The disadvantage of Sans is, like, you fucked me on this Bolton thing.
Yep.
Clap him in irons. He's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how it's going to play out for Littlefinger. And I don't know that Littlefinger needs to kind of survive his own manipulations, right? I think maybe he could get caught up in his game so intensely that he gets it out of hand.
Climbing the ladder of chaos, it's not a stable thing.
No.
Like, you can just as easily break your neck.
I just played through Uncharted. I know all about unstable ladders.
Okay. No spoilers, man.
Oh, it's not a spoiler to say there's an unstable ladder in Uncharted. Ladder. Yeah.
Okay. No, but yeah, I mean, it's impossible to see everything, but I, and good job on you, because that was, you definitely served up some dry pie through the feedbackers.
Taste it.
But I was kind of blown away at that suggestion. Like, it's one of the things I kind of felt ashamed, because, like, oh man, I should have picked up on that. That's certainly a possibility.
It's possible. Let me throw this out. Do you think John's a little selfish for only fighting for his family? Like, only when Rickon is under threat of flaying.
He laid out a pretty good case of why he's had his fill of fighting.
Like, I agree. I mean, to
the extent that, like, here's the other thing is, like, I don't have a problem with people being selfish. It's kind of like there's an extreme to it, but, like, you know, it's the classic, when the airplane's going down, even if it's your 3-year-old sitting beside you, you put your own mask on first, because if you can't help and care for yourself, you can't take care of anyone else.
Absolutely. But I know there's going to be a lot of people saying, oh, it's noble and it's righteous of John to go in and kill the Boltons. Well, that's kind of not what he's doing. He's just going to save Rickon, right?
No. Well, I mean...
And his sister obviously wants to take back Winterfell a lot more than he does.
Sure. But I don't know. What are you trying to accuse him of? Because, like, let's say that...
I just don't want it to be all rah-rah John. Like, he's doing this out of some familial obligation.
Sure.
Yeah. Not out of the goodness of his heart to preserve Westeros, right?
Because I think he was ready to fuck off about the whole thing and, like, south and get warm or whatever. But, you know, I don't know. Like, he might have come around to that anyway and warmed up to it in time. And Sansa's just, like, pushing him in that direction. But on the other hand, like, she makes a valid point that we'll never be safe as long as this guy sits as the Lord of the North. It's just...
But I feel like it's something you got to talk about with Davos pushing him and saying... go do more things that are right.
Well,
that got me killed.
That goes back to our mathematical equation that 0 is worse than 48, which is worse than 2,000. Like, if you think that this guy's going to come and kill you, then you have, even if, like, the theoretical threat of the White Walkers, well, they're not at the gates yet.
Right.
These guys are, and they're threatening me, so maybe I have to. It's like, there aren't any really good decisions left to be made. Those decisions were like 3-4 years back.
Sure.
There's now the best you can make of the situation you're getting. So it's like, I don't really want to go too hard on John because...
Oh, I don't either. I don't want to go too favorably on John either.
Sure.
Which I feel like is the inclination of the audience at this moment. Let's go to the Dosh Kaleen. Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
No,
it's Vaze,
the Widows.
Vaze Dothrak, which is this capital city.
Okay, they're you know, or whatever. They're meeting to determine what to do with Dany, and she's acting super smug, and they're threatening her, and they're like, "Why is this lady doing this thing?" And then she one-ups them by not only threatening them, but then burning them all alive. And she walks out of the Furno completely unharmed, and the entirety of the Dothraki prostrate themselves in front of her. So apparently, loyal to her now.
I thought this was visually incredible.
Yeah. And for people rooting for Dany, oh my god, this scene.
Yeah. And her just walking out there, mother naked, but like with that roar of the fire behind her and like all the, and just her like staring down all these people like,
yeah,
come at me.
And the nudity here, I feel, serves a symbolic purpose. I don't think it's just nudity for nudity's sake here.
Oh, hell no.
It's to show she doesn't need shit aside from herself.
Like, yeah.
Here I am.
And
boom.
I don't know whether it's non-sexualized or sexualized nudity, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder, but
I didn't think it was.
It's awesome. She's just standing here, like, you know, framed in this heroic pose, and she's got this, you know, she's powerful, and she's got all these people that are, like, seeing her as a goddess. I thought it was And again, it's like a greater fulfillment of her initial promise in season one. Like, before, all I had was Jorah and a couple of hangers-on and some old sickly people. Now, I've got I'm doing this, and now I'm acquiring real power. Because I was still a beggar queen at that point.
Right.
But now it's all come full circle. And we got some really good feedback on kind of how full circle this episode's come and some deeper things I want to talk about. And I'll save that because I'm not all about slicing up and serving a dry pie.
Okay.
But talking about the scene in detail, I like the kind of humorous legal debate that established these cows as kind of lightweights. So our prejudice against them is like these guys are kind of small potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dany as much as says so. Like, you know, you are all small men. You're not fit to serve, but I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the music when she grabbed that brazier and tipped it towards him, it kind of had this bass snarl that turned into like the Dany triumphant music.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's a Dothraki chant. I don't know exactly what you would call this, but I thought it was awesome. The literal roar of the fire is like almost like a dragon like when it was consuming the building. Jorah and Daario both falling to their knees. Jorah going back for the second look at the naked Khaleesi, the old dog.
Does he? Does he do a double take?
they both look and then they fall to their knees. They do. He looks back up and is like, still going.
This is what you're missing, Jorah.
That's right.
And what Dario's not, so get a good look.
No, it's Jorah. Jorah is the lecherer that's getting the second look.
Right, that's what I mean.
Oh, well,
Jorah's
said,
missing it, Daario ain't.
Oh. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, he's left out in the cold,
right.
Jorah.
He doesn't need the mental picture. Dario's got the whole thing.
Take it in while you can, Jorah, because you're not seeing this again.
Yeah, it was interesting. Also, that subtle detail of the old masters trying to bribe the Dothraki with 10,000 horses.
Right.
That's
a
pretty...
The young guy.
That ain't nothing.
No, it's not. And you get the impression that they would not do nice things to her either.
Hmm.
If they got a hold of her.
I mean, at the very masters. Minimum, she's going to be on a cruciform.
Yeah.
At the side of a road somewhere.
Right.
It just gets worse from there.
Yeah, I mean, you put 1,000 heads on pikes? 1,000 slavers
like a
strung up?
Maybe 100 or... It was a bunch of children is the especially disgusting thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and then didn't Dany do...
She did,
with
I think,
the masters.
She did, like, I think it was 100 children. She did 100 of the wise masters.
It was 100? Okay.
Whatever the number was. It was however many miles they were from Marine.
I get the impression they would have done similar things to her.
Sure.
But yeah, awesome scene. I don't know how much more you want to talk about it, but...
I mean, I thought, like, there's some people... It's funny because there's been this weird fan rumor about, like, Emma, what is her name?
Amelia Clark.
Amelia Clark, signing a no nudity, renewing her contract with a no nudity clause. And I'm like, I don't
apparently
really
not.
Give a fuck either way. Like, if you don't want to appear, like, you change your mind, you don't want to appear naked. And, like, I, you know, I don't want to appear naked in a Hollywood production. So, like, whatever.
Mostly because
there's not a long enough lens to catch my face and my member in the same scene. Har! There's some torment.
Yeah, the giant's blood.
Torment humor,
yeah. You're saying?
But no, I don't give a shit. But it seems like that was false because she was saying in Entertainment Weekly that no, this is totally me. Like, this is me. I'm fit. I'm strong. I'm powerful. And that was what that scene was all about. But it's hilarious because, in much the same way that a lot of people criticize, like, remember in The Phantom Menace? Where they were attacking the frog fucking men.
And Yoda showed his tits.
Yeah, no. Uh-huh. How they like the tanks were rolling in on these lush green hills and everyone's criticizing how much that was CG and then you find out that was actually a real scene.
Ha! Tasty.
A lot of people were saying in the Reddit thread before that article on Entertainment Weekly
this
posted that I can see the mat lines and I can see the stitching on the neck and look at this bullshit. Like, obviously, there's a lot of CG compositing going on because she's not standing in the middle of a fucking inferno.
But, A, you're just flat out wrong on that anymore.
Right.
Like, if it was 1982,
yeah.
if it was 90, 91, if it was 93, Jurassic Park, whatever... Mm-hmm. Maybe, but you're not seeing that shit anymore. You can't.
Yeah.
CG is so good now, you cannot see it.
I mean, have you seen...
If they don't want you to.
Young Robert Downey Jr. in Captain America 3?
Right.
And we forgot to talk about that on the podcast for it, but holy shit, that was eerie.
Now, you throw a rubber Drogon on the screen.
Sure.
And you have him fly off with some poorly composited shit. Sure, you can see it. But
and you have Emilia Clarke climbing on him like he's made out of glass and knives. And like, I don't know. You know, right. That doesn't hold together as well. But
yeah.
Yeah, when they want to and they got the budget for it, they can absolutely kill it.
And this is a scene they want to nail. So
having said that, it was, I feel like it's her, not that it matters. I feel like it was her real body and now everybody can shut up about it.
I don't care. Like, the Cersei thing didn't bother me either, that it wasn't her real body.
No.
Don't care. And I actually saw that there were articles about her talking about this nudity thing. I was like, yeah, okay, you're nude.
Uh-huh.
Whatever. I've seen Kevin Bacon's dick. I don't care. Like,
did you really see his dick or was it prosthetic?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, that's about all I have to say about this episode.
This week's episode is sponsored by Casper. They are the purveyor of obsessively engineered mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And right now, you can go to casper.com/GOT and use GOT as a promo code to get $50 off your first purchase of mattresses. And it's funny because after last week's ad, I had some people write on and to me and be like, you know, Aaron, is this like a marketing thing or do you actually believe in this mattress? And I said, yeah, I sleep on a Casper mattress. I've done so for over a year, and I love it. It's different than any kind of memory foam mattress because it's a blend of memory foam and latex. It solves a lot of what I think a lot of people's problems with it are they're too stiff.
The heat
retention with the latex supposedly solves, and they have what they like to call just the right sink, just the right bounce. And I find that to be true. But here's the thing. You don't have to take my word for it. If you're in the market for a mattress, I don't see how you can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because go to some other mattress place and get and sit on their mattress for 5 minutes or however long you feel comfortable doing so at a store. And decide whether that's going to give you 8 hours of good sleep at a night.
Yeah.
And then purchase a mattress for thousands of dollars, bring it home, and you find out that, oh, man, I woke up and I feel tight, I feel stiff. What are you going to do? It's not like they're going to take the mattress back.
Mm-hmm.
Casper lets you sleep. They got 100 nights that they're going to give you. You don't like it. You say, get this mattress out of here, and they're going to take care of it. They're going to pick it up from you. And I've heard of several firsthand experiences from people, either are Walking Dead fans or Game of Thrones fans, or said that they tried it. And ultimately, it didn't work for them because that's the thing. It's a Goldilocks situation. Some people want soft. Some people want firm. I think this is a great place for the majority of people. But if it's not for you, it's risk-free. So that's the thing. Like, people want to know whether I truly believe in a mattress. I sleep on one every night, and I think it's awesome. And that wasn't like I was replacing it with a I wasn't really replacing a cement floor. Like, right. I had a nice king-sized major manufacturer that was like 2 or 3 years old mattress. I replaced it with the Casper and I immediately noticed the difference, not just from the quality of sleep, but the fact that because it's memory foam, there's not as much jostle transfer when, like, you know, I don't sleep alone. I'm fortunate in that. And that there's no cross transfer of the motion in a mattress. There's like a lot of nice ability. It's manufactured in America. It ships to your door in an easy to use package that that you get into your bedroom and it like unfolds. The smell, that's the other thing that I'm usually concerned with the memory foam mattress. That thing dissipates in like less than I let it air out for a whole weekend, but you know, and when I got back, I left on Friday night, I got back on Sunday, it was ready to sleep on, no smell at all.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great piece of engineering. $950 for a king size, all the way down to $500 for a twin size, and you get $50 off if you go to Casper.com/GOT and use the promo code GOT at checkout. Terms and conditions apply, so be aware of those. But it does seem like a great mattress at a great price, and you can try it risk-free.
Do we have some feedback?
Oh, we have so much feedback.
Let's probably do that.
Alex W. says, not a really complaint, but what the fuck is a slice of dry pie? I may just be an ignorant Brit, but I don't know what the phrase means, but after 3 seconds of Googling, I couldn't find it, so I thought I'd write and say, I love your show, and what is a slice of fucking dry pie?
That is a holy bald move invention, yes?
Yes, sir.
That's one of your things?
Well, it's something we came up with in season 4.
After Joffrey.
Joffrey died, and like someone say, like, why, you know, who poisoned him, and I think Tyrion said in his trial, perhaps he had a slice of dry pie.
Right.
And I think Joffrey, as he was choking, said, that was some, can I have
this
some wine?
This pie is dry, I need some wine, yeah.
So when and the way we structure our podcast is we come armed with outlines, but we don't pre discuss the thing with each other except for the instant podcast. So,
and one of us does all of the feedback.
So frequently Jim will inadvertently, with his own ideas or whatnot, step on a feedbacker, and I don't have time to re-edit the feedback in between recordings. So, like, I started just saying that you got sliced, you got served a slice of dry pie.
Yeah.
And you start not be able to finish your email.
Yeah,
so,
you can't finish your email, so we move on.
Yeah. So that's when we do the dry pie, it's essentially like, you had a great point, Jim fucked you on it, and we got to move on.
Taste it. Taste it.
So dry. Okay, Mike Mc. That's the thing, though. Like, we have so many inside jokes, and it's a statistical fact that 50% of you were not here last season.
Right.
And 50% of you for last season were not here the season before that.
That's true.
And 15 to 20% of you that are here now were not here in episode one. So it's like, ah, that's one of the good problems.
We're divided by spoilers. Like, there's all sorts of divisions.
Some people don't listen to our feedback section. It's all good problems to have. But sure. we ought to have some kind of like wiki that has all of our insights so people could just go and check.
You know, that's something we would probably Mike do if it we were better to. At this.
Mike McSee said, both of you sounded very troubled over the number of black brothers that Jon Snow hung in the final scene of Oathbreaker. If you didn't know, obviously these are first few emails right. from previous weeks.
4 verse 6.
I think the explanation is very simple. It could be one of two options. One, the remaining traitors were killed during the skirmish of the Wildlings. Or two, the traitors were killed off screen and the scene focused on the main conspirators. I could be wrong, but I think Jon hung the main lieutenants of the Night's Watch and Ollie, since he dealt the killing stroke. In my opinion, the Double D's just focused on the traitors that we were at least vaguely familiar with. I mean, my thought on that is that's exactly what a plot hole is, though. And this is like a plot hole that also could be a continuity error.
Well, for me, plot holes are things that could not plausibly have happened given other events.
They're
in
a gap
the show.
Of our understanding of the show that can't be explained by things seen by us, the viewer. And some people wrote in that I saw it as so minor of a quibble that I didn't consider it, is that Tyrion's wine glass level was all over the place in his drinking game he was trying to play.
Right, and Jorah turns around magically in a scene with Dario. It doesn't... I don't care.
But I will say that I think that the bigger the continuity errors and the plot holes get, the more it's... Like, there's everyday sloppy continuity Hollywood errors because this is just impossible to keep straight. From a practical matter. But I do think that, yeah, sure, they might have died unseen over the scuffle over John's body, or maybe they died off screen, but...
Well, you certainly got other explanations for this, yes? Because I saw 1,000 of them.
I'm just saying, like, I'm not interested in talking about them, because...
Okay, well, for people who are, like, super curious,
okay.
The one that I saw that makes, I guess, the most sense is that Tormund killed one of them, the Giant killed the other, and that's 4 left.
So,
because we saw 2 people die.
Okay, so
they
6
happened
people stabbed.
To be the
there was
guys.
Much more people watching it, but John didn't hold them personally responsible.
Right.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So I'm just saying like the implication, if you buy that it's a plot hole or the reason you'd care is because it shows that they don't care themselves.
Right.
And that is a troubling for a long term trend on the show.
Can we talk a little bit about timelines too? Because
if you want,
there was
to.
Some stuff that. It could be considered fishy, I guess, by some people on the timelines. Because, the last episode we had Sansa saying we're heading north, and then boom, this episode they're there.
Mm-hmm.
We had Theon saying I'm going home. Boom, he's there.
Yeah.
Which we know those journeys would have taken weeks. To me, I mean, they are... I've almost written off the timeline in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care because, like, eventually these things come back around to where, like... Okay, well, we're showing you 2 weeks later on Theon's timeline, but we're showing you a day later on John's.
Yeah.
Or a day later on Ramsay.
Yeah.
Clearly, all these things can't be happening at the same time. So I almost don't care to even try and follow it.
But it feels natural to me coming from the books, because much like in Lord of the Rings, the Twin Towers, or the Two Towers, rather, you have these parallel... timelines of events that like you kind of see the whole story and then they go back, rewind time and tell you the story of what happened to the other group. They do that a lot in Dance of Dragons and Feast for Crows, where things are happening parallel, but if you just go by book order, it's give you a false idea of what's actually happening. And that's the thing, like, this stuff is only like, when did Greyjoy die? Like, did he die at the same time that you know, Sansa met Brienne, or did that happen like weeks before or weeks after? Like, you don't really know, right. And you don't know how much time is elapsing before each between each show.
And that's why I don't care.
Yeah, it's like it's just fuzzy enough that it suits, you know, it suits the showrunners, I think. And it's kind of like the same way that, you know, in Star Wars and Star Trek, they make it a point that everything's solved with hyperspace or warp or transport, right?
Yeah.
And it's only a point about, like, you can't get there in a certain time if it's dramatically important. And they always say, like, oh, well, we've been knocked 3 days away from the planet at warp 9, whatever. Like, I feel like this is the same way. When it's a problem, the show will tell you. And I get that that's a little bit loosey-goosey and sloppy, but...
Yeah. And I'm
as
sure...
As long as they execute at a high level, you won't care.
Right.
When they start dipping and doing slipshod shit, you're going to start noticing how this doesn't make sense either. So they have to tread carefully. But in my mind, they're treading it very carefully. It's working for me.
And they're jumping around so much, it almost doesn't matter to me.
Yeah. And, like, you know, people have been saying that in the forums and on the Reddit a lot about how Peter Baelish apparently has a jetpack. He can get to the Westerlands, to the Riverlands, to the Vale, to King's Landing.
We haven't seen him in episodes.
I'm talking about last season.
Oh, okay.
He covered a lot of fucking land.
Right.
So, but I just, that doesn't bother me because they are executing the other stuff at such a high level. And also, they're like in a tough spot with the actors' ages.
Sure. I mean, Robin, look at fucking Robin. He's taller than Littlefinger now.
Yeah.
He grew like 2 feet in the off season.
Right. So I think their nebulous sense of time works out well for them.
Yeah.
And also, I thought it's interesting that the young Dosh Colleen mentioned that she was like 12 when she was essentially sold into slavery and raped by her cow.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what happens to Dany in the book. She's like just turned 13. And I wondered if that was a nod to kind of like, yeah, this is kind of fucked up in the books.
Could be, yeah.
Whereas Dany, like, always played as, like, more of an 18-year-old, and now she's a, you know, mature woman. And Arya, like, in the books, Arya should be, like, 9 or 10 years old, still carving up dudes. It's easier to take because Maisie Williams is going on 18 last season. And
yeah.
So I think that works in their favor, that as the material gets more adult, they age up appropriately. But in the books, this stuff all happens over a span of, like, a year.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway... let's see. H.D. Chapman says, thought I'd mention, in case you didn't see it, that there's a brief moment before Arya drinks from the poison fountain where she's kneeling in front of a fire. If I remember right, the House of Black and White has little shrines for all the different gods from all over the world. In this week's scene, she's kneeling in front of the Weirwood, or Old Godwins, which seem relevant to me in that in the is she really no one or is she still Arya conversation. That's clearly intentional, right? That's the show telling us that she still has some loyalties to her old way of life.
So then... If that's true, if that's
it
what
is.
The show
it's
is trying...
It is. Definitely the old gods
no,
she's
no,
been
no,
looking
no.
for.
I mean, if that's what the show is trying to tell us, if that part of it is true, then we have to believe that this water is not somehow controlled by the gods. And she either we have to believe that this water is not designed to poison her, because if it was, it would have killed her, given that she isn't totally no one.
Huh.
Or we have to believe that she fooled the gods, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no two ways around it if you think that that is actually the writers and the
Or she fooled
Jacken. Telling us.
Like, if Jacken's like, the poison's in the glass, she fooled him.
Right, right.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. Like, not actually going to kill her.
Yeah.
If she's not no one.
Or the god. Or the other explanation is the gods don't care. The gods are real, they just don't care.
Okay.
Like, this is something that the... You know, that's always a possibility, that God is real. He just doesn't give a shit about you chopping the tip of your dick off.
Right. This is
that's
a project he worked
that's
on
something
5 years
got,
ago.
That's something that got introduced into the narrative a couple thousand years ago. And he's like, I can't sweat everything.
Right.
Like, or, you know, he just doesn't care one way or another. So I don't know. I mean, that's what's interesting about the Game of Thrones world is you can't. I think what your view of its religion says a lot about yourself.
Sure.
And not so much about, you know, what Martin's trying to say.
Yeah.
Like, if you're, I imagine that, you know, if you're a Christian, you can come in and see a lot of allegory here. Whereas if you're an atheist, you can see kind of stuff that fits your own worldview. Like, oh, this is all just some kind of metaphysical thing that they don't understand.
Spoiler alert, that's true of all art.
Yes.
So, it says more about you than it does the creator.
Yep. Let's see. Meredith H. says, are we supposed to read something into the fact that Jon Snow decided his watch was ended only after he got a vengeance on those that killed him? If his dying is what releases him from his vows, isn't it a bit dishonorable for him to continue to use the power of his position to condemn and execute the traitors, then immediately decide his watch has ended? Just the only thing that seemed a bit out of character and didn't feel right. Maybe it's how normal Jon would react when being arisen from the dead. Maybe he isn't thinking clearly. Maybe the resurrection has indeed made some subtle changes to him. Jim, what's your analysis
made him
of that?
Stupider. Oh, God.
Made
Took
him dumber.
20 points off his IQ.
He's wearing his hair more Ned-like, I noticed.
He is. He's got the little pullback knot.
Is that intentional after we saw young Ned and John comes back and he's rocking the young Ned look?
It could be. It could be. I also have to wonder, like, if this is maybe not reflective of John so much as it is the Black Brothers, like, and how they view John. So, like, this mantle is forced upon him when he comes back, right? They still consider mm-hmm. him the Lord Commander. He needs to act as such for the moment. Even when he gives up his cape and this letter comes in, he tries to tell them, no, I'm not Lord Commander. Uh-huh. That's it. Give it to him.
Yeah.
And the guy doesn't even budge. He mm-hmm. just continues to hold it out for John. Right. So, like, maybe they are expecting as much of him and he's just acting...
I thought that was funny because John was expecting it to be just another raven, but this is like, it's not just for the Lord Commander. It's specifically tailored to you, bastard.
How would they
come and read?
Do they let the Bolton, the House Bolton guy in there to deliver that letter? How would they know? Like, does the Bolton guy say this is only for John?
I don't know. Wait, you're saying did I miss that the Bolton guy delivered it? I assumed it was a raven.
No. It wasn't like horseback.
Oh.
A guy with a flayed man shield.
Okay.
Rode into the gates.
Well,
with a flag indicating he's a messenger, I guess.
I don't know what they're doing now that Sam's going to the Citadel, but there's always a person whose job it is to, like, usually it's the maester of the Black Brothers to kind of like manage the ravens. So assuming that there's someone there that's reading John's mail to know who,
but
they couldn't have
because the seal wasn't broken.
Oh, that's right.
So the Bolton guy must have said, hey, this is for John only.
It's funny because you got me on a serious dilemma that I can't explain, but I don't really care about.
Right. Right. I'm with you.
All right. So if anybody wants to take a stab at it, maybe we'll read it. Maybe we won't.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I'm with the emailer here in that John should refuse a little bit more.
Mm.
Like, if he really doesn't want to be Lord Commander, refuse the status.
Yeah. And if you're taking off, you're fucking off anyway, then what do you care that traitors are still alive?
Right.
I guess you want to leave.
He's not protesting enough.
Dale DV says, this may be dry pie at this point, but I want to piggyback on a theory that a previous listener, Rick S., commented on. In Season 3, during an Arya training montage, Arya is asked about her list. I believe she will be sent to Westeros to take out the rest of the people on that list. Most of the people on that list are still alive and have unnaturally long life. So this is the idea of maybe Arya is going to be sent to take out Jon or the Mountain or someone that's dead and shouldn't, you know, just alive and should be dead.
Right. How would you get Cersei, though?
He lists off the people who still have a natural long life. The Mountain, the Red Woman, Beric Dondarrion, even Theros of Myr of giving a natural life.
Okay.
The Faceless Men may send her to take her out or take, wait, may send her to take out her list as a way to give a great rest to those that are due. Jon Snow could be added to the list, but she may save his death for when he's ready and echo the words of Cyril Farrell. What do we say to the God of Death? Not today. So the idea here is that Arya, and I talked about this in previous seasons, that Arya has had different trainers at different times. Like in Season 1, Cyril Farrell was teaching her his philosophy. Season 2, arguably, Tywin Lannister was her teacher.
Sure.
Along with Jack and Hagar. Season 3, arguably, who was teaching her was the Hound.
Yep.
And now she's back in with the Faceless Men. I thought it was... The reason I read his email is I thought it was interesting, the concept that she would take from Syrio one of her earlier lessons, which is, what do we say to the God of Death? If indeed she's sent to kill someone who is alive and should be dead, that's a great... I could see her saying that line as a way to get her out of her mission. Like, she's essentially got two directives that are conflicting.
Okay. I mean, I'm working under that premise that she definitely does.
Okay.
Until we deal with Needle.
Okay. She definitely does what? I'm confused.
That she definitely does have two different goals.
Okay, gotcha. Shelly K says, one thing about the Tyrion drinking game scene from season 6, episode 3 that I didn't hear you mention is how it is the flip side of the drinking game scene with Shay and Bronn in the first season. Tyrion has always had someone who understood him close by his side. Bronn, Shay, Podrick, Jaime. He's been without that companionship for a very long time. Last season was about his sheer survival, but now that he has survived, I think he's moving on trying to survive emotionally the only way he knows how. This scene is showing us that he's coming back to being Tyrion after a harrowing season 5, only being Tyrion isn't working in the new world. He's going to have to figure out something else. As a writer, I was intrigued. That's a pretty hot take, I thought.
I don't remember this scene with Bronn and Shay at all.
So he plays this drinking game where it's essentially never have I ever with them all in his tent as a way to getting to know them.
Okay.
And this is an echo of the scene with Missandei and Grey Worm, except for it fails spectacularly, but it's essentially Tyrion trying to make a human connection with them.
Yeah, and trying to use his old ways in the new world and failing.
Yeah, but the fact that he did it successfully in season 1 I thought was really nice narration, and I fucking whiffed on it. So.
Yeah, but I mean, even if you don't catch that, which I didn't,
it works on
it
other
still
levels.
Works, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
It just doesn't work on the comedic level.
No, it does not.
for me, personally.
Tony V wants to know, how common is being a green seer? Bran is both a warg and a green seer. Are most people both or one or the other? In the books, it's mentioned that like 1 out of 1,000 Northmen or children, you know, whatever, are wargs or skin changers.
Really? And that seems so common.
And 1 of 1,000 of them are green seers.
That's like everybody. That's essentially everyone.
That's 0.0001% of the population?
Right, but that's still a fair amount of people. Like, I thought the Starks were special. So Stark's not special. Starks,
well, if you take
just
those,
thousands of wargs.
Look, motherfucker, let's talk about odds now.
All right.
The fact that all these would compound into one family is kind of special.
Okay.
Well, I mean...
Depending on how it's inherited, right? Like, is it inherited via blood? Via being a relative. If that's the case, then it's not special. It's just a guaranteed fact.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought the Starks were the only ones who could warg.
No.
Is the premise I was working under.
Well, I mean, you know that's true and wrong because we saw one of the wildlings was able to warg into his falcon back in, like, what, season 3? He was able to use his, like, he was their scout, essentially.
Right.
So, yeah,
right.
No,
I
it's
had
not
forgotten
just
about
a Stark.
That.
It's
okay.
More of a North thing.
Okay.
Because those powers are all connected to the old religion.
So is it a cold thing? Is it like...
I mean, I had an interesting...
Is it the North religion?
I had an interesting email about like how, you know, essentially how do we see this world? Like is magic... Is there God? Are there multiple gods? Is there one God? Is there this one force that people are ascribing to gods? And like that's what I'm saying. Like that's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, everybody sees
like,
it differently.
Like me, coming from a, you know, agnostic atheist perspective, I see there is probably a like capital S source of this power, much like Star Wars and the Force.
Which may or may not be supernatural.
And it's polarized. You've got fire and ice. You've got life and death. You've got light and dark. You've got fire. Well, I already said fire and ice.
You got
good and evil. But they're all they're just essentially polarity or electricity can have a positive or negative charge.
Right.
Doesn't mean there's two forces of electricity. It just means that you don't fully understand the mechanics. So I guess I see the universe of A Song of Ice and Fire having this one force that motivates it that people see differently. And, like, I guess the Faceless Men are the closest to the ones that have a true understanding, which is there aren't multiple gods. It's this one thing that we don't quite understand, and it has one name, and it's got many different aspects, and people worship it in different ways.
Yeah.
But that's because, you know, I think if you're... And it's very similar to the way that, like, you know, the Abrahamic religions all, you know, Muslims, Jews, Christians all kind of worship the same God.
Right.
But they don't. And, like, the more fundamentalist you are in those religions, the more you'd say that the Jews and the Christians or the Muslims are heretics and you have the true faith.
Right. It's the difference between being, like, a theist and a deist, I guess.
Sure.
Where one believes that there's something out there and the other believes that it's a very specific thing.
Yeah. And like, you know, Christianity is a monotheistic religion.
Yeah.
But they worship a trinity, but that's okay because it's just different aspects of one
of
God.
The same. Yeah.
I mean, this is all like that. In fact, I think that if you look at this, that, you know, the faith of the seven is broadly like Roman Catholic. I've always seen You know, the gods of the north are kind of like the pagan gods. The Lord of Light is Christianity. There's a lot of stuff that kind of maps to real life religious systems. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's intentional or whether, you know, he was just trying to, just like, you know, Game of Thrones is based broadly on the War of the Roses.
Yeah.
And what happened between the Yorks and the Lancasters?
Man.
But it's a super loose, super loose analogy.
Right.
Either way. Let's move on. Rachel B., in discussing Game of Thrones 603, a friend brought an interesting theory to my attention, and I'm wondering your thoughts. Back when Bran was crippled and in a coma-like state, and after being thrown out of the tower, all the direwolves are still alive. But when Lady is killed from Nymeria's attack on Joffrey, Bran regains his consciousness. Now that we've seen Shaggy Dog's head represented to Ramsay, could that be linked to Jon coming back to life and not therefore having to do anything with the Red Woman? I never made this connection before, but it makes sense since all the Stark children seem to be linked to their wolves and therefore to each other. She wants to give credit to...
But they're linked to...
Her friend Adam for this theory, but she wants our thoughts.
Linked to each other's wolves? Like... Because, you know, it's not Ghost that's killed. It's not... It's not Bran's wolf that's killed.
Uh-huh.
So, like... I don't know.
Well, so... The other thing that that was talked about a lot in the various places where you talk about Game of Thrones in the internet, Reddit and our forums and whatnot, is the idea that the name of Rickon's wolf is Shaggy Dog.
Mm-hmm.
And have you heard of the Shaggy Dog story, like Hollywood concept? This idea of like it's essentially like the comedic form of a MacGuffin. It's this long-winded anecdotal story about the Shaggy Dog that at the end has no punchline and has no point. It's a red herring or distraction. Okay. Is Martin cheeky enough to name Shaggy Dog and make that plot be a Shaggy Dog? Like that this is a diversion from what we're really supposed to be paying attention to?
I suppose it could be.
I mean, that's back into like, this is not really the Shaggy Dog head theory, which I think is dubious, but I don't know.
Right.
Karina D. says, and related, I think that the head of Shaggy Dog the Umbers presented to Ramsay was really Shaggy Dog's head, but that he was killed somewhere on the road with Rickon and Asha before they hooked up with the Umbers, perhaps defending them from stray wildlings or wild animals. And the Umbers came up the idea of using Shaggy Dog's corpse head for the conspiracy against the Boltons. Why is everyone debating if this is really Shaggy Dog's head or not, when this would work just as well? That's another thought. That isn't it the fact that Asha immediately tried to kill Ramsay proof that the Umbers are not completely on the up and up with their offering of Bran as a gift?
I don't know if it's proof. It's certainly evidence I would say. Yeah, it's good, a piece of evidence that lends itself toward that reading. Sure. And really, you kind of have to check out the spoiler podcast to get too much more in depth on Rickon, right?
I mean, it's mildly interesting for you to say that. Right. Fuck, man.
I'm just saying, like, sure. There's stuff from the books that is relevant here that
that
I now know about that I can't talk about.
See, it's fucking mildly interesting. That's why I came up with the phrase. Brett F. says, Aeron, king of shippers, caster of pods, mispronouncer of names. I just did it again. I strike again.
Perfect. Couldn't have written it better.
Regarding Brienne and Tormund, what are the odds of you shipping this love story? Does Brienne strike you as the type of person who hook up with the first man to ever really hit on her? I don't think he's got a shot, but do you have a lot in common? Brienne escaped from the Bolton's bear, and Tormund claims to have had sex with one. Maybe it was the same bear. Small world, best icebreaker ever.
Same bear.
First of all, Brett, I have to take I have to take umbrage at your suggestion that there is a type of woman that would hook up with the first man that ever really hit on her.
Right.
Like, is she too nice of a girl? What the fuck does that even mean in Game of Thrones? Like, she's
no. I feel like she's too reserved. Almost. Mm. She's like too guarded.
She's like, you know, solar Catholic schoolgirls, but you know, there's a lot of tropes about them. I feel like that is Brienne a sexual being? I thought with her chemistry with Jaime that she is. And if she ever finds the right guy,
if she ever finds Tormund in a hot tub, it's on.
They need to go back up north of the wall, find those caves.
Yep.
administer the Lord's kiss and
bow,
deal is sealed. No, but I
want to make the distinction between first person to hit on her and like first person to genuinely hit on her. Like, I don't know how Tormund views this exactly.
I'm a Brienne Jamie shipper, so I would argue that there was a little bit of sexual. Well, there was a lot of sexual tension in their relationship.
Was. Yeah, for sure.
That's controversial, but whatever. This is my podcast, and
I agree with you.
I like Brienne and Jamie.
Yeah. So the other thing is, like, how much of this for Tormund is like a conquest versus like this is the first person who's impressed me. Like, how genuine is this idea of like I'm attracted to Brienne versus like I just want to conquer this giant?
Well, that's what I said. Like I said in the outset, like this is just a woman who can breed me warrior children. That's
right. That's
another type of objectification and conquest.
Absolutely.
I don't know.
What do you think Tormund is looking at her with?
See, that's the thing. Like,
what's going through his head?
I think Tormund's a big, like, one of those big talkers.
Okay.
And that he actually might be a decent guy under all that.
Especially the dealings he's had with Jon Snow. And
like, do
Hardhome
I think he's actually
like...
fucked a bear? No, I do not. So...
I'm on the fence about that.
He would be actually somewhat hysterical. No, I think he actually mentioned that he's had... sons and daughters or something along those lines, but it'd actually be funny if he turns out to be a virgin. He's just the guy that brags about everything. Yeah. He's got nothing. They're like, have you never even seen a vagina, have you, Tormund?
We're going to high school politics here, and
turns
out Jon Snow, the kind of nerdy, like,
yeah,
you know, reserved guy, is the one who's actually fucked, and the rest of them,
yeah, but he's dispensing all this advice about how you got to get a girl as slick as a baby seal, and then,
right.
Yeah, I
Tormund,
I don't know.
You don't sound like you've actually done this.
Yes, exactly.
You sound like you've maybe seen a Playboy,
yeah,
or
right?
a penthouse.
You've
once.
Read some Dear Penthouses, some Dear King's Landings. But I know I gotta say this was not on my radar, but I'm liking what I'm seeing.
Yeah,
and I don't know, like I don't know how Tormund's going to pursue it, if he is going to pursue it.
I don't know how Brienne's going to feel about it.
You know, as long
she was kind of giving him
I feel like as long as he's honest about his intentions, he'll come out smelling like a rose.
Right.
Like if you're not looking to wife her up and to put a ring, just as long as you're like, hey, this is just about sex. I mean, she's an adult. She can make her own damn decisions.
Maybe Brienne's asexual. Like she just doesn't
Possible.
Give a shit about it. I don't know. But like me as a sexual being would like to see everyone get something genuine and something nice in their lives, right?
Sure.
So, like, I don't know how Brienne feels about it, but I would like for Brienne to have something because she never has, right?
That's why I'm a shipper. It's not so much I'm a shipper as so much as I just like to see people, like, yeah, that's the chief joy of me watching Penny Dreadful, for example. It's like, everybody should just fuck. Yeah, you're fucking too. All right, now bring it together. Get a four-way. I mean, yeah, it's like...
Frankenstein, the werewolf.
Sure.
Get with Timothy Dalton.
Sure.
Let's do this.
Yeah, get weird with it. Get the mummy in here. Unwrap right. him.
Get Josh Hartnett in his Sin City outfit. I don't know. Fucking do it.
Uh-huh. So, but yeah, I would like to see Brienne be happy. And if that's Jamie or Tormund or fucking Brandon Stark.
Or nobody. I don't know at this point.
Sure.
But it seemed like Jamie and her...
I thought so. And she clearly loved in a girlish way Renly. Like, I think she would want to make it better. That was the funny thing is that Renly
wanted nothing to do with,
you know,
that
sexually.
Yeah,
he's a vegetarian when it comes to that kind of thing. He eschewed that particular brand
implying
of meat.
That she's meat. Objectification of it at its worst. I'm ashamed of you, Aaron.
Patriarchy runs deep, man. Subconscious. Lindsay L. said, I had thought about this newest episode of Game of Thrones, the line where Peter Baelish asserts that it's time to get back into the fray. Seemed like a very deliberate choice of words.
Yep.
Of course, on the surface level, he's talking about getting back to being the master manipulator he is, but he could be making a remark about Walder Frey and his family. I only read the first book, so I realized the spellings are different, Frey versus Frey, but Littlefinger is far and away my favorite character, and I'd love to see him kick some Frey ass to avenge the death of Kat and to control the twins for the wars to come.
The only woman he's ever loved, conspicuously.
The only woman he's ever loved. That's a hell... I mean, I get it. It's the difference between Frey and Frey, but...
But that stuck out to me, too,
yeah.
Watching the episode.
Damn, Jim, you are on fire. I didn't catch that.
I didn't mention it. I should have.
You should have.
If I
you
wanted
should
to
get
claim.
All the internet. You're letting these valuable internet, like slices of dry pie, are not
I
being
know.
Served. What the fuck?
I know.
Nick S. from Indy. says, are we sure that Varys is on the up and up? No. Next email. I've always felt that he's a character similar in vein to Littlefinger. He's manipulating the black chess pieces and Littlefinger manipulating the white. Varys is a big part of the reason that Tyrion has to flee King's Landing, and I feel like we've just kind of trust him because Tyrion does and the relationship is great. Maybe Varys is asking a slave woman with his asthmatic son who is funding the Sons of Harpy because he wants to know if his name is known as the source. He reported the slave owners of the three cities were behind it, but they claimed they weren't in the meeting with Tyrion. Of course, they wouldn't admit it, but it's concerning that we're just taking Varys at face value. Insightful email, Jim. What do you think?
So I'm confused as to why Varys would need to verify that his name was not being named if he's part of the conspiracy. Wouldn't he be? And not only is he part of the conspiracy, but he's the guy naming the names.
He wants to know if his name's in the street. Does he need to worry?
Well, the name's only in the street if you put it out there, Varys, because no other names are in the street.
No, but I'm saying that if people are whispering that Varys is, like, that would be useful information to know. Like, how well has he covered his tracks?
Yeah,
Here's the thing, why do we implicitly trust Varys? Because I guess if I'm going to be honest about it...
Because he helped Tyrion after killing Tywin.
And I don't see him sitting the Iron Throne, so as he seems like this character who seems genuine and that he wants to serve the realm. Now, that is extremely naive, even as I'm saying it.
Absolutely, and
Because he can't have a progeny and a line and all that stuff doesn't mean that he doesn't want power.
No, he might have seen the writing on the wall.
Sure.
With Tywin's death and with Cersei taking over and just been like, let's do this. I'm going to back Tyrion and we're going to go over here and we're going to do this thing from Essos. Like, I'm going to get out of harm's way and I'm going to work my machinations from here.
No doubt.
So it's not like I implicitly trust him to the end that he's on Tyrion's side necessarily.
Uh-huh.
But I trust that he's not on Cersei and the Lannisters' side.
Sure.
So.
I don't know. I've always thought he was the genuine one. Like, he's the one that...
Really? I feel like Danny. That's Danny.
No, I'm talking about the master manipulators.
Oh,
which essentially is essentially, what, Littlefinger and him? That he's the one I can trust because he seems to be giving good, solid advice. But then so did Littlefinger before he pulled a knife on Ned, so...
Right.
I don't know.
Bastard.
Richard R. says, what are your deeper thoughts in regard to the high spirit situation? I'm tickled that you think that we've got like some reserve. We're just doling out the shallow thoughts. We're going to sum it up all. We're going to give you our true feelings of the High Sparrow. Me? Richard speaks for himself. I think he knew Tommen would tell his mother and his entire situation was a trap. I could be wrong because I definitely have seen this before, but whenever a character says, I'm going to tell you something I promise I wouldn't tell, I instantly feel as though it's a setup. Lastly, I'm beginning to think the Ashen scene is an indicator that Umbers had a plan where they turned over Rickon. Unfortunately for them, the plan went bad. Of course, with all that said and done, Sansa and Jon are still together, the Vale is on its way, and the Umbers are behind enemy lines. I can't help but hope that we finally see the Starks take back Winterfell. We talked about a little bit this in the podcast. I want to see if you had any final thoughts on... I feel like the I'm going to tell you something I promised I wouldn't is pretty much dry pie, but what about this idea that the Umbers had a plot, that this was conspicuously, they weren't pledging allegiance and they weren't doing anything that, you know, the Umbers take their oath seriously. If you wanted to go on this assumption that the Northern people take their oath seriously. So he's unwilling to give it to someone he knows he's going to betray. He introduces Asha as the wild card, presumably right. To kill, like, you know, she's a guided missile and she goes and tries to do it. But then, oh shit, didn't work.
Yeah.
Are we going to open up next episode and we're going to see the small John Umber flayed for a suspected betrayal?
Maybe. Can Ramsay get his hands on Little John?
He's presumably still there at the castle.
Is he?
Well, he wanted Ramsay to join forces. I can't imagine he's going to drop off the gift and be like, peace.
Oh, well, I thought he would take forces with him.
Mm.
Like, head north.
All right.
But... That's just my assumption. Okay. Well, I think the more interesting, like the deeper thoughts on the High Sparrow, it's my opinion that the High Sparrow is trying to create a civil war here. He's trying, like his speech to Jaime about, you know, being, you know, not having swords or whatever,
yeah, we're nobody.
But being a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And we're
expendable.
We're strong in our numbers, yeah. That sort of thing. That's him trying, like saying, hey, I'm going to incite a civil war here. I'm going to incite a war that's going to take you guys down with the little people, who are the peasants, who are the people of King's Landing.
Sure.
That seems to be his main goal. And I think it looks like it might work, but I don't know. The Lannisters might be able to turn the tide their way mm-hmm. if they play their cards right.
Yeah, I mean, like, Napoleon, isn't it he used to say that quantity has a quality all of its own?
Yeah.
So there's that.
Right.
Kevin B. said, the lady slaves or prostitutes that Tyrion gifted to masters have got to be yet more little birds who will report back as spies to Tyrion and Varys, right? And if so, I was surprised that Tyrion didn't make that clear to Missandei, considering the serious shade she was giving him when they came in. It would be pretty seriously dilute his message to say slavery is bad and we want you to end it, and as a token of our goodwill, here are some slaves. We talked a little bit about how...
Man, they'd have to be stupid.
That's kind of a problem to... I mean, yes, they were at the best reading of the situation is these are former slaves that volunteered for a distasteful mission at high rates of pay.
Right.
Every assumption about that you walk back becomes more and more distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
Even from a psychological standpoint of, like, you know, how much free will do they have being raised under this system and all that kind of stuff.
But you're postulating that these are actually
spies in, like, the American sense of the word.
I always hate this trope of I'm going to sleep with you and get information out of you, because
I bet
unless
it's super
you...
fucking effective though.
Really?
Man.
I mean, unless you have some emotional attachment to someone, why would you tell them anything aside from just fucking them? Like,
I just say, like, I know that there's enough real-life spies that do that, that is a emotion, that we are cultural.
But you have to build an emotional attachment. That's not what's happening in this scene. This scene is about fucking prostitutes.
But what I'm saying, like, is, like, the way I think also, because I've read several accounts of high-priced call girls that service very rich and powerful men, and it's amazing how they run their mouth through their women.
God, they're so stupid.
Well, yes, people are, especially when their dicks are involved. Or their clits, if you want to go it from the other angle.
I didn't read that into it, but I suppose you could.
It's an interesting theory that they're actually, like, we're conditioned to think at this point that his little birds are children, but it could be just any socially disadvantaged group that people would dismiss and not take seriously as a threat.
But you also have to not take seriously as a threat the masters of Yunkai and Astapor and Volantis. Uh-huh. Like, you have to dismiss them as idiots, right?
Well, it just takes number one.
Right.
Number two, like, it's a Hail Mary, but it would be a smart play. Like, maybe they're not going to say, hey, we've got X many troops and X many boats, and this is our... But maybe they just make a statement about how much...
Yeah. Like, oh, we'll see about that tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they go, oh, well, there's an attack tomorrow.
Right. Something. Like I said, it's...
We'll see about that at the games.
Indeed. Let's see. Luke B. said, wanted to chime in on one of Loras's and Marjorie's scenes in episode. In the instant take, you guys didn't seem to know what to make of it, but I think I see what happened. He goes ahead and summarized what I essentially passed off as my own thoughts, it turns out. So I wanted to give Luke B. credit for essentially the idea that Marjorie thought that she was going to go and give... That the High Sparrow thought that she broke her, but really the High Sparrow used her brother to break Marjorie.
Yeah.
So he laid out all those thoughts.
Oh,
I wanted to give Luke credit.
Dry pie.
No, but I'm giving
taste
him credit for the pie.
Mm-mm.
Just came up organically in the conversation.
Want some wine with that?
Organic, cruelty-free, farm-to-table, dry pie. 100% recyclable. Responsibly sourced. Jessica H., cruelty-free. I can't help but feel like this was a really important episode for the women of Westeros.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of complaints about the way women are used in Westeros. I thought it'd be nice to read one where we acknowledge the fact that women kind of kicked ass in this episode.
I feel like we did that in a recap, but sure, yes.
In this episode, we got to see a lot of very empowered, strong, complicated, and determined female characters. Sansa resolved to rid the North of a monster, pulling Jon out of his very understandable reluctance. Marjorie's determination not to give in to the bullying of religious fanatics and her entreaties to and comfort of her much weaker brother. The interactions between Yara and Theon were amazing, and I never thought I would love a scene in Pike so much. even the alliance, which is almost certainly to go sour between Cersei and Lady Olenna. Brienne continues to be amazing. I'm glad she finally found a man who appreciates her, especially given her backstory. Although I was sad to see Asha go, it's nice to see a woman using sex as a weapon, a la Cersei, and not having sex used as a weapon against her. Asha was able to be active in her final moments, not a passive victim.
Wait, that's not a trope. Come on.
A role that women are too often relegated to. Dany's almost literal barn burner of a power play with the Dothraki, this episode really cemented for me that women of Westeros are the real players, not the pawns. Back up. Are you saying that it's not a trope that women have sex used against them?
I feel like it's almost a trope that women use sex. Like, it's a weird objectification that women use sex as a weapon, and that's their only weapon.
I think if you think of it in terms of when Hollywood give women a juicy role to play.
Right.
And it's a character moment. It's almost always a vibe. And you can see this everywhere from, Special Victims Unit to Star Trek The Next Generation. When Troy got a plot line, flip a coin, heads, it's some bullshit with her mom. Tails, she's getting cyclically raped by some character of the week, you know?
Right, but then on the other end of that spectrum, or on the other side of that coin is women using sex as a weapon to, like you said, get information.
Seriously, that's also a trope as well.
And that's their only weapon, right? Like, but it's the only thing they've got going for them.
But it's a pretty well-established trope that character development from women is by physical or sexual violation in their bodies. Like River Tam, you know, she was an interesting character because she was abducted and experimented upon against her will. It's not always sexual, but that's definitely a storytelling trope that, you know, guys can... You know, men can have many ways to develop their story, but women, it seems like that's, you know, because there's a lot of reasons for that. Most writers are men, and they don't really understand women's issues, and that stuff is slowly getting better. That's the reason, by the way, this is why diversity is not some social justice warrior bullshit thing. It makes more accessible and interesting stories for everyone, because you have interesting backgrounds and points of view that make stuff more interesting and less interesting. If it's just a bunch of dudes sitting in a room imagining how women think, automatically less interesting and less accessible.
Sure.
So let us move on. But yeah, no, I wanted to acknowledge that this was a great, great episode for women to kick ass in Westeros and in Essos.
And they've done quite a few of those in recent history, you know, like... A lot of women getting shit on at the beginning of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like I said, the show takes its lumps when they, you know, mishandle female characters. But stuff like this is why I think it's a very shallow analysis to say that, you know, the Song of Ice and Fire or Game of Thrones or broadly George Martin are anti-female or anti-women.
Absolutely.
Like, that's a pretty shallow analysis. Yeah. I understand why people approach it and like, oh, God, all the rape. But... I think ultimately...
And when you start out in this series, men do have all the power. I mean, make no bones about that. Slowly, we're seeing a lot more diversity of power here.
Uh-huh.
We're seeing men who are, you know, doing the bidding of women in a lot of cases.
The wheel is being broken.
Right. I mean, that comes down to Sansa and Jon at this point, you know?
Anna W. said, also, am I the only... Or wait, also, that's a bad edit. Am I the only one who thought that Dany was a little too comfortable burning the cows? Yes, it was an epic power move, but yes, it seemed a little bit Mad King of her. So this is constantly something that I've been watching, and is whether this is a fake out by Martin. What is Martin playing at? Is Martin setting up Dany to be the deliverer of Westeros, or is she going to be the Mad King reincarnate?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I think the stuff we've seen of her recently in Meereen has not given me a lot of confidence in her ability to lead.
Yeah.
Even though maybe she has a claim on it, even though maybe she would do a good job if her idealistic feelings could win the day.
Yeah.
I just don't think she's a very good practical leader. Whereas now she's kind of got the ultimate dream team here. She's got Tyrion. If she comes back with an army,
she's got Varys.
Now she can rule.
She's got good advisors.
Right.
I think that they do a good job of, and the books do this as well, as showing you both sides, and you kind of can see the madness and the capableness, but kind of entwined, the fire and the blood, all kind of bound up in her.
Yep.
And you know, because in, even in this scene, it's like, who's to say she might be a little bit more mournful if they hadn't been making epic rape threats about
right.
all
yeah.
of them and all their retainers and all their horses, you know, raping her to death.
Fucking her till she dies, yeah.
It's... Yeah, so it's like, I think you could be triumphant by putting these people to death. And maybe if they had
Absolutely.
Been a little bit more absent-minded, if they'd been a little bit more mindful... she would have been either sorrowful or maybe they even walk out of there. Is there a version of the world in which they walk out of that alive? Like if they're like,
I don't
you're
think
right.
So.
We're, I mean, I don't think they're
I mean,
capable.
Tradition. I don't think tradition would
sure.
allow it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I mean, what are they going to do
for themselves that she brought the dragons and
right.
And they've heard about the dragons, but
yeah, I just think like, I think she has the right idea. I just think she needs good advisors around her and she's slowly accumulating that.
Amber F., I interpreted the Danny fire scene as those bulls. We talked about an instant cast, how maybe people would have a problem. I was anticipating people having problems with some of the scenes, and I found that no one did. Like, there was no meltdown thread on the Song of Ice and Fire subreddit. Huh. There wasn't people. I mean, there's a couple people saying, like, it's a little convenient that they burnt this. I'll let Amber yeah. say. I thought that those bowls of fire were burning with oil or some kind of flammable material. So when she tipped the fire over, the oil spilled out everywhere and thus burst into flames.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's unrealistic to assume, like you did, that Dario and Jara had any access to in the hut. I think their only part to play was in barring the door shut and killing the guards outside. I read a couple other people talking about how it seemed unrealistic that it went up so quickly, but I think the answer is perhaps simpler than that. I will just say that I feel like regardless of what you want to believe, they did an adequate job of explaining why that thing, like either the brazier's full
yeah.
oil or Dario and Joris, you know, did some fuckery with it. Something happened to where I can believe that she tipped over those brazers and the whole place went up and it was a shit show.
Yeah.
So and the fact that there's almost no one calling bullshit on that, I had like maybe one or two people out of 1,000 send me an email saying that I thought it was strange. Like, the scene was awesome, but it is strange how fast that place went up. It's a thatch yeah. hut made of wood and grass, essentially.
Yeah,
so,
but it's kind of not. Like, if it was thatch, they'd chop their fucking way out of it. It's more solid than a thatch.
But if it's thatch on fire, like, I don't know, you chop your way out of that.
No, I mean, I was looking at it. It's not thatch. It's like
okay.
some construction
okay.
beyond just straw put up on a... put it stacked vertically.
But like, I don't know what they burn on braziers. Were there charcoal briquettes or what? That the fact is, it's not like just a candle. You
no,
know,
no,
it's
no.
a significant fuel source that's going to burn for all night long. So,
right.
Like I said, I think they did more than enough to suspend my disbelief anyway.
Yeah.
Josh L. said, I think what struck me most thematically about this episode was the echoes of episodes past. Danny, of course, pulls the same trick she did at the end of season one to even better results. Asha tries to do at Ramsay what she did to Theon's guard and gets killed for it. Theon once again stands on a boat as he returns to Pike, seeing his old home in a much different light than the last time he arrived. An entirely different man from the ignorant, arrogant boy he was before. I especially like that last one that we didn't point out, but that is a clear echo of when he came back as, like, I am the man that Robb Stark has sent, and I've got my Greyjoy finery on, and I'm the heir to the throne, and I'm going to stuff my fingers down this wench's pants who, oh my god, it's my sister. Completely different guy at this point.
Yeah.
And nice echoes, as Josh mentions. Anything you want to mention? Or
nope.
Jackie L. says, during the scene, in the scene with Cersei, Jaime, Lady Olenna, and Kevin, listen to the musical cues. At the moment Cersei convinces Olenna and Kevin to sit down and listen to them, the cellos kick in, and as the four of them come to an agreement on the plan, the melody makes its way into full-blown Reigns of Castamere territory.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of dry pie in this email, but her question is the vengeance here going to be solely for the Sparrows, or is it going to be directed some to the Tyrells and old Uncle Kevin as well? The impending King's Landing bloodbath will be a great opportunity to camouflage any tricky assassinations that folks have in their to-do boxes. So this is something we didn't talk about. We talked about how this is going to be a four-way clusterfuck, but is Cersei going to try to off, like, Lady Olenna, Margaery, Kevin, etc.?
I mean, I feel like I talked about this. I think she's going to point the finger.
Mm.
Say, look, these are the fuckers who came in and did this thing, and if you want a civil war... you want to take somebody down, take down the Tyrells, not the Lannisters.
Moving on, Sean B. said, I love the parallel between Queen Marjorie being humiliated by being paraded around nude by the Sparrows and losing face and respect, but Dany gains an army of 100,000 by being naked and on fire. I think there's some interesting symmetry there. One is a shameful display of nakedness, and one is a powerful display of nakedness.
Mm-hmm.
One is someone head down in shame, and one is head up in defiance. And like the look that Dany was firing at like everyone.
Yeah.
She's just like looking down her nose and daring people. It's fucking awesome, man.
Yep.
And that's the last email, turns out. I just miscopied it into the wrong outline.
Well, it's a long episode, so I'm glad that's the last one. We're significantly over time, you know. The allotted time we've given ourselves.
That's true. We're almost out of podcast.
Almost.
The tape is almost. It's we only have.
We should have gone EP instead of LP, but what are you going to do?
Or we should have got the 120 minute, you know, the 120 minute where you can fit a whole album on a single side of the cassette tape.
Or we should maybe just abandon tape altogether.
Go digital?
Yeah.
You think we should?
I think so.
All right. Well, you know, it's
next
certainly
episode,
saved
all digital.
Time mailing the copies off to Libsyn. If you'd like to send us more feedback, it's easy to do so. GameofThrones@baldmove.com and on forums, forums.baldmove.com. If you want to discuss the episode on the forums, please keep the spoiler threads separate from the non-spoiler threads. It would save me the effort of moderating you. And we are not done this week. Hell no. We have a whole spoiler section coming out Friday where we try to debunk some theories from the books or prove theories from the books based on new information from the episode and vice versa. It's kind of fun and it's a great place for adventurous show watchers or battle-hardened book veterans to give their thoughts on the episode without having to worry about spoiling people. So we'll be back with that on Friday, and then we'll have another what promises to be a banging episode of Game of Thrones on Sunday with the instant cast. It's just a snake eating its own tail. We're never stopping. Yeah. Never stopping.
For six more weeks.
Six
we're never
more
stopping.
Weeks. It's just a never stopping. 6 weeks. 18 more podcasts. Can you stand it?
Cool. Well, we will see you guys either Friday or Saturday, Sunday. And until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. Bye-bye.